a better way. And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3592 of the Survival Podcast. And today I get to do something I've kind of wanted to do for a long time. I first learned about a gentleman named Alan Booker through Paul Wheaton with a course that he was selling on plant genetics and epigenetics. And I took that and I was absolutely blown away. And then I finally got to meet Alan last year in Tennessee, and then I got to meet him again this year. We actually shared a place together this time where Nicole put us up in a Airbnb. Got to talk to him quite a bit about some of his work beyond the genetics that we're going to be talking about today. This dude's a warrior, man. If there's a place with a problem, it's environmental and something can be done about it, he's probably some way hooked into it. The work that he's done already for Maui and the work that he's doing right now in North Carolina is pretty amazing. So when I get to interview somebody that I truly admire, that's always a great day. And we'll get to do that in just a moment. Before we do, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor today, number one today, is Above Phone. How about this idea? Instead of having your app makers, your carrier, and your device maker like Apple or Google all spying on everything you do, recording all your data and giving it to the government and selling it to companies, how about you make that all go away? You can do that with Above Phone, where you have your own private ecosystem. You have the Graphene OS installed on your phone. I don't know what that is. You don't have to. They'll do it for you. And if you're an MSB member, you get $75 off any phone at AbovePhone.com. And your Above Phone comes with a one-hour consultation where they will walk you through the transfer process and help you move off your legacy device onto a device that is freedom-oriented. But Jack, I got this one app and they don't have anything and I need to use it. Great. You can create a jail on your Above Phone. You throw that Google Play or iOS app inside that jail and it can only do what it does when you let it out of jail. That means you only have it acting and doing things when you decide, and otherwise it's locked in a nice little app prison where it belongs instead of giving your data away. And I turned it on private. Yeah, I'm sure that works. With Above Phone, you can be sure because it's open source, and that means there's people all over the planet that are looking for any holes in it so they can be the person that found it. You're not going to get that anywhere else. Check them out today at AbovePhone.com. And remember, MSB members, you get that $75 off any device, and my membership's $50. So if you buy a membership today and buy an Above Phone today, you're already $25 ahead of the game. Next up today, USABerkeyFilters.com. Jeff, the Berkey guy, has been supporting the show since 2010. That's 14 years in the world of podcasting for a sponsor. That is a long time. So check out USABerkeyFilters.com. They do have full Berkey filtration systems available with the filters in them. They are still working on resupplying their inventory of filters over the whole lawsuit BS with the FDA. That's probably about to go away. So what you want to do right now, if you're going to need new filters soon, you already have a Berkey, get on their wait list because they're going to go first come, first serve as those new filters come in. With that, let's go ahead and bring our special guest on, Mr. Alan Booker. Alan, how are you doing today, bro?
Oh, doing great, Jack. Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad to have you today. We're going to talk about genetic capital and plant genetics today and animal genetics as well. Before we do, though, can you give people kind of your background? I know you're an engineer by trade. Yeah. So you went to engineering school. I don't even know what specific discipline in engineering, but somehow you ended up in this world of biology and chemistry and environmental systems and all this other stuff. So what did that path look like?
Well, I actually got my undergrad degree in electrical engineering and got out right about the time when this thing called ARPANET was being opened up, and we decided to call it the internet. And so we really were just at that moment of inflection when it was time to scale up the internet and make it global. And so I got pulled into what would be called at that, you know, now cloud computing and digital telecom and all of that really early on. And so that pulled me into systems engineering almost immediately. Like, you know, how do we make this thing big? How do we go full scale planetary with it and everything else? So, you know, and so pretty quickly I ran into this question. I was looking around because I grew up outdoors, You know, I had aunts that would take me out and teach me herbal medicine and, you know, teach me the ecology of place and so forth. And so these two things kind of ran into each other. And I realized that a lot of what I had been taught to do and a lot of what these people around me were doing as part of the engineering and so forth was destroying a lot of the ecology. And so I ran into this question, I guess, back in the early 1990s, which is, why am I surrounded by all these brilliant people designing technology and all of it destroys the planet as a side effect, right? Can't we do something better than that? Can't we create technologies that sort of work with the ecosystem instead of destroy it ultimately? And so, yeah, pretty soon that got me into looking around and asking the question of, you know, who's actually doing things that work? Mm-hmm. I'm an engineer, so I'm pretty mm-hmm. practical, right? It's like the saying is nothing succeeds like success. Go find the people who are actually doing a thing that's working. And early on in the early, you know, like the later 1990s, when I was really digging into this, one of the groups of people that I ran into were the permaculturists. It was one of the only groups I could look at and say, oh, look, they've got examples of successful things going on in multiple biomes, in multiple climate zones, on multiple continents around the world. And so I'm really interested in what they're doing, because it's not just a bunch of theoretical stuff that people are throwing around, but there's some practical solutions. I can go and I can stand on the land and I can see the solution and so forth. So by the late 1990s, I was looking at this. I got a copy of the Permaculture Designer's Manual, the big black book sent over from Australia, because at that point in time, I couldn't find a copy here in the U.S., and started studying at that point in time. And that got me into the whole set of questions around how are we going to do, you know, technology, any form of human technology in a way that is going to be sustainable and regenerative over a long, long time period. So that kind of started me on my regenerative and, you know, mindset journey back, oh, somewhere around late 1990s, around 2000. And I've been kind of pursuing that ever since.
Excellent. And we're going to talk about genetic capital today. And I almost didn't put it in the title, because I think if somebody doesn't know what you mean, it could actually be antiviral as far as getting traffic. But there's not really a better term for it. And I think as we dig into this, people are going to understand, like, this is one of the reasons this is really a deep topic for me, is I like to talk about things and bring guests on and talk about things people can actually participate in. You know, that's why I like biochar, because for all of the high tech, high end stuff, you can do it. Anybody, I just put out videos on how to make it in a Weber kettle grill.
Yeah.
And what to do with it. So anybody can do it, and anybody can do this and be a part of this. So when you say genetic capital, that sounds like some highfalutin term or something, but it's really just an accurate descriptor. So can you talk about what you mean by it?
Yeah.
Why it's one of the most foundational forms of capital and wealth that we can build.
Right. Yeah. You know, there was back a good number of years ago, there were several different variations in the permaculture community on this idea of the eight forms of capital, you know. And in the way I look at things, money, our current system of currency, is not capital. I don't look at it in my model that way. It's a pointer to capital, right? It's so when you think of I've got money in the bank, quote unquote, that's a form of capital I have to work with. I'm like, well, in reality, that is a social contract that points to your access to real capital. And so there's all these forms of real capital. Your land is real capital because you can do something with that. You can grow things on it. You can make it productive, right? Or better put, you can't make it productive. You can cooperate with the land being productive.
Correct.
Right. Right. Then, you know, as I've jokingly said, my cast iron skillet is a form of capital. I don't care what happens in, you know, in the global economy, I can always cook my dinner with it. It's a form of a way of making value for myself, as in something that I am, you know, I can feed myself and my community with that. And so there's a lot of different discussions about social capital, you know, knowledge capital. It's like without knowledge capital, it's hard to make anything of value. You don't know what to do. And I looked at all of this, and nowhere in all those different forms of capital that were being listed was the genetics that we work with in order to be able to be productive on our land. So one of the examples I give is you walk onto a piece of land, it is bare dirt. Okay, what can you do with it if you do not have the right genetics in the form of plant genetics and animal genetics to actually be able to help regenerate that land and make it productive? If you don't have annual crop genetics, perennial crop genetics, and livestock genetics, then you're out of the game. You can't go anywhere. So to me, it was like, well, to create any form of real wealth that's sustainable, genetic capital has to be one of the foundational things. And if you look at the history of how humans have valued different forms of capital, you see that when people were forced to migrate from one place to the other, right, they had to flee from one land into another in order to save their lives. What do they carry with them? Well, in almost every case, what you saw was they were carrying the seeds and they were bringing their livestock, their yep. breeding stock, right? So here you go. It shows you how highly valued it was that people would literally sow seeds into the hems of their clothing to make certain that they got it through into wherever they were going successfully. So they might try to bring some gold through or some, you know, precious metal or something that they knew had some value, but right alongside that, they were bringing the genetics that they knew they needed in order to grow their food and be productive.
Yeah. And I mean, I kind of look at this as like, if you want capital to be durable, it has to be living.
Yes.
And I can explain that with like a fence. So let's say I go out and I buy the best metal I can get and I put up a metal fence. That fence might last 50 years, it might last 30 years, it might last 25 years, but one thing we know about that fence, the day I put it in, it is degraded by one day on day two,
right?
And 2 days on day three, and it will degrade every single day. No matter what I do, it will degrade. If I were to take something like willow and build a living fence, yes. as long as somebody prunes it once a year, it might last 500 or 1,000 years. And it can regrow itself while it's not, when it finally like kind of is like toward the end of life, we can literally take sprouts and put it right next to it and build a new one. And my, you know, great grandchildren times 20 could still use that fence.
Right.
But there is no way that metal fence will ever do that. And it is only life that creates the ability to regenerate. Without life, we don't have that. So yes. of course it should be the most valuable capital we can hold. Cause to me, capital is like wealth in a battery, right? So when we take currency, especially like something like a fiat currency, like the dollar, we have a battery that leaks, right? Mm-hmm. And it's weak in what it can do. And it doesn't really do anything until we expend it on something that actually does something. But if we have life as the battery, then that battery can actually recharge itself, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So in broad categories, an asset can either be a regenerative asset or a degenerative asset. So like you said, a metal fence is a degenerative asset. You put it in, and on the day you get it, it starts to degenerate. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting is that degenerative assets, there's two subcategories. One is a productive degenerative asset, and the other would be a consumptive degenerative asset, right? So a tool would be hopefully a productive degenerative asset. That is, yeah, it's going to degenerate. You buy that new tool, you start to use it, it starts to wear down. But in the process, you can produce a lot with it, right? There are other things that you can buy that are both degenerative and consumptive. Sorry, the video game you've got, you might enjoy it, but it's not producing any long-term value for you. It consumes electricity, it consumes physical resources, it produces waste. And it doesn't produce at the end of the day, even if you know, I guess maybe you could say there was some productivity if you and your family could get together and play the game and enjoy sure. it. But itself, it's a consumptive degenerative resource. All of the regenerative resources we have so far are living resources. They are things that are that are alive and know how to regenerate themselves. And the reason that that difference is so important is because there's another set of ways we need to look at assets. It's capital. One of them is that there is scarcity-based capital, and there's another called abundance-based capital. And if you have always worked in the world of money, money is categorized in the scarcity-based, right? The value of money is based upon its scarcity. If you put more money out there, the value of the money that's already there goes down. The reason that gold is valuable is because it's a scarce resource. If there were, you know, if gold were as abundant as aluminum, then its value would not be what it is. That's a scarcity-based form of capital, right? There's another form of capital called abundance-based capital. And what that means is that when you share it, you get richer. When you distribute it, you get richer. Knowledge can be abundance-based capital if it's done right, because if you share your knowledge with everybody else in your community, then what happens is everybody else in your community can be smarter about what they're doing, and you can wind up benefiting from that. So you share that knowledge, and the next thing you know, your quality of life goes up.
That's a really interesting distinction. Yeah. And it's, you know, houses are valuable because it takes a lot of work to make, and there's only so much housing. And when you don't have enough housing, the price of a house goes up. Yes. But if we were to make it where houses grew out of the ground and everybody could just have a house, nobody would buy a house.
Right.
And if you think about the alternative, what we do with like a subdivision, we go in and we build all the houses. They might have different floor plans, but they're all the same. Same building material, same roofing material, same framing, everything's the same. So all those houses actually go into full-on degradation at the exact same time, and the whole damn neighborhood declines in value, even though it's a limited resource, because the resource itself is going to decline. And if you have a neighborhood where people can't really afford to kind of piece it all back together and hold it together, that whole neighborhood crumbles together, and people go, oh, what happened? It's not always that a bad element moved in or whatever. Sometimes it's just the degradation of the material that the place was built with all happened at about 25 to 30 years, and the neighborhood itself did not have the affluency to be able to put it back together, so everything went in. And I've seen it happen to neighborhoods all the time.
Oh, yeah, especially when they're poorly built by somebody who's, you know, just trying to make a buck. I go in and look at neighborhoods, and I tell people, if you buy this, you're going to buy a 20-year house with a 30-year mortgage, right? And yeah. And they're like, what do you mean by that? It's like, in 20 years, this house is going to need substantial investment in order to be able to continue to be feasible, right? So we're going to call it a 20-year house, because after 20 years, you're going to have to put a lot more money and resources into it. But one of the things I want to point out is genetic capital is abundance-based capital. That was correct. Kind of where I was going with that. It's like, and the reason that that's important to figure out is that when you share the really great genetics that you have with your community, if that community has a community food network and culture, you become richer. And the reason for that is that what happens is I go out, I happen to love Cherokee tomatoes. You know, I've got some really great cultivars of Cherokee tomatoes that are adapted to my particular valley that I'm in here.
Sure.
Right. And so when you grow tomatoes, you're going to have way more tomato seeds than you could ever possibly begin to think about using. So I save those. I have extra tomato seeds. I give them to other people who are interested in growing nutrient-dense real food, and all of a sudden, two things happen. One is I have an offsite backup of all my genetics, right?
Yes.
If something happens to my tomato seeds, there's several other people who have that who can give it right back to me. Number two is if we're all doing good work on saving those seeds, then each of us is developing co-evolving lines that are adapting to local conditions, and we can cross trade in the future in order to be able to bring the genetic biodiversity back into each of our seed lines, thereby benefiting all of us. The same thing is true with livestock, right? You can breed extra livestock. You can give breeding pairs to people in your community. Pretty soon, you're de-bottlenecking the genetics of the livestock in your community, and you have a lot of genetic abundance around you in the community. You are richer for giving away all that genetic wealth than you would have been if you hoarded it.
And I think what's important is how portable that is, right?
Yeah.
Like, if I develop a, like, I'm pretty well known for my jalapenos that I've been growing for 20 years now. Even though they started in a standard cultivar, they are not what they were 20 years ago. They have evolved onto my property. And if I send it to, say, Bill in Florida, they might not, they're going to not be ideally optimized for his climate. But if he starts doing it, they become so. And I've got good base genetics to hand over to him. With things like livestock, I work with Jersey Giants for my chickens. If I had a neighbor doing that that had a different line and we both get ours in really great shape, we could swap a rooster and we can increase our genetic diversity but maintain that breeding line. And that's all very easy to do. It can even ship, you know, chicks. You can ship eggs that are then hatched.
Yes.
And so this is a very portable form of wealth. But you also say that it is a precondition for food sovereignty.
Yes.
And I agree with you, but can you kind of talk about why the ability to grow food with nutritional integrity and maintain rights to those genetics? Because there's a threat to, when you get really great genetics, there's people that see the value in it if they can put a little, you know, trademark or a patent on it, I should say, and basically then close that down, even if somebody else, because I saw this happen in Iraq.
Yep.
When we were there to give them freedom, we were stealing their genetics and Monsanto was patenting them.
Yes. Yeah, it's been really interesting to watch all the case law unfold around patents on living things, right? And because there has been a lot of lobbying by agribusiness, you know, huge lobbying, a lot of money being spent, they've been able to get, you know, laws kind of pushed in their direction, but they've also been able to litigate court cases that are the outcome of which are really pretty startling, right? Where people have been trying to grow highly organic strains of certain kinds of crops, say corn or whatever, right? These are heirloom corn crops, or landrace corn crops. And somebody is growing a genetically modified corn with a Monsanto patented gene in it, and you get wind coming through, and you get that, you get basically what I call genetic trespass, right? It's like, I don't want that genetically modified junk in my heirloom landrace, you know, genetics, but here it comes. And then here comes Monsanto Bayer. Monsanto got bought out by Bayer. And, you know, they sneak onto your property, grab a sample of your corn, realize that it has been cross-pollinated, even though you didn't want it, and comes and sues you because you are now growing their genetics, right? So
there was a very famous case of that involving canola, exact same way with a farmer named Percy Schmeiser.
Yes. So it's like what they're trying to do is they're trying to go in and figure out ways to patent as much of the genetics as they possibly can and begin to lock it down and get it down to the point where sharing seeds back and forth is under attack from several different directions, but one of them would be intellectual property laws, you know. So, they've been a little bit less successful in the United States than they have been in Europe, where in Europe they have been quite successful in sort of intimidating a lot of the seed exchanges and small seed vendors, and also regulating them out of existence.
Yeah.
It's the same thing that happens over and over again, where the large industry can afford to, you know, follow this huge list of regulations. So they go in, they get all these regulations passed. They are the only ones now that can afford to follow all those regulations, and they can use those regulations to drive their small competitors out of business and create a barrier of entry so that anybody new just is like, can't even get in the door.
Yep.
So it's like, if we don't actually start to manage our own genetics in our communities and protect that and create very biodiverse genetics that are adapted to place that we exchange person to person inside of our own communities, there is an active move to try to shut down the commercial distribution of these kinds of seeds and make it much more difficult for people to access it.
Again, we've seen this happen over and over again around the world. And I think you bring up a really good thing about their genetics getting into your genetics and then suing you for it.
Yeah.
But then there's also the other side where they grab something that somebody else has developed through selective breeding over time, and then they go patent it, and they have the money to patenting shit's expensive.
Yes.
It is not inexpensive. Call up a patent attorney and say, I've got a thing I want to patent. And then tell them it's biological, and then you better have a big checkbook. You're starting to write some six-figure checks or more to do that, and they only do that because they can make billions off of it over time. They want to make the poison that you spray on the plant and make the plant susceptible, allowing this poison to be sprayed, so they can sell you the seed, the fertilizer, and the poison all in one go. And they really it's thievery. And I'm not totally opposed to IPR. I'm certainly for using it. I think we're probably going to talk about how we can turn that back on them here in a second. But I don't think we should be able to look to patent life. A process by which you do a thing, okay. An application that you use it for afterwards, okay. But the life form itself that's capable of moving and invading my – I don't want Monsanto's icky gick shit in my genetics.
Yeah.
I accept that it will be there because what am I going to do? Put a you know, one of those domes like science fiction around my house. I can't do that. So I accept that, you know, if you take melted snow off of friggin' Mount Fuji, it probably has plastic in it. Like, we can't stop that. But then, I'm not a biblical person either, but principles are principles. And like, it's not my responsibility to fence your stuff out. It's your responsibility to hold it in. And so to allow your ox to come in my field and then say you own my field because the ox is there.
Right.
That's what's going on. And this is – so what can we do about that so that we can retain the rights to the genetic capital that we develop? Because like I said, everybody listening to us right now and everybody that will listen to us over the next couple of days as this goes out on iTunes and Spotify, everybody here can participate in this. And Absolutely. You can pick one thing – and you can start developing your own genetics with it. So once we do that, how do we protect it?
Yeah, I mean, it turns out to be like two parts to that question and a response, I think. One is we're being attacked on the regulatory front, right? And so I think there's, you know, with these big companies with a lot of money trying to come in and regulate it and make it harder and harder for us to do anything. But I think that practically, community level response is very hard for them to shut down. Mm. When we as communities start dealing with each other as individuals in the community, and we begin to share genetics back and forth, then we can begin to create biodiverse, locally adapted genetics. And those locally adapted genetics are going to be different than anything they're patenting, because we are – what's really interesting is they're diverging. What I mean by that is that all the stuff that Monsanto and the other big seed companies are doing are becoming more and more genetically bottlenecked and more epigenetically poor, because they are growing them in this toxic – environment that does not allow for them to express their genetic potential, and that they continue to breed them closer and closer. So when they patent a thing, what they're patenting is they're patenting this thing we wouldn't want to grow any which way, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas if we're doing our job, we are actually in, we're growing our food using ecological cultivation. What ends up happening is if we do it right, we end up with higher and higher bricks, plants that are healthier and healthier, and they become less and less genetically bottlenecked. And so they have more genetic biodiversity. They're much healthier. They are all the way up to expressing, say, in crop side, they're up to expressing plant secondary metabolites and everything else. They're highly nutrient dense. All of a sudden, that genetics and the epigenetics that go along with it are radically different than anything that Big Ag has and is patenting. So I think the way we protect ourselves is by getting together at the community level and cooperating to share genetic capital and to develop it carefully, so that what we are do what we have as part of the genetic capital in our communities is so much radically better than what all these seed companies, you know, Big Ag seed companies have, that they're not even in the same ballpark. And that's fortunately not hard.
Yeah, I mean, so if you think about it, like, you take a plant and you take a string of genetics that don't belong in that plant at all. You know, there's a fish genetics that's been forced into cotton, for instance. There's genetics, I believe it was from like a snail or something that they made some sort of stacking corn with or something. And so you stick that in there. But what I hear you saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is not only have they done this and created this kind of genetic bottleneck, every seed is the same, mm-hmm. right? It's designed. So the most important thing about it is you can spray our chemicals on it to kill the weeds and not kill the corn or whatever.
Right.
But then we're also growing it in terrible conditions. So if it's adapting to anything, it's adapting to growing in an inert media versus a biological system, and therefore it must become weaker over time.
Yep.
Because it's not adapting to life, it's adapting to 40,000 acres of essentially hydroponics.
It's adapting to not dying.
Hydroponics, right?
It's adapting to just barely living and not dying is what it's adapting to. It's called chemical cultivation. It's what I call chemical cultivation, right?
It's so like, that's backwards, because I've always thought when you're doing genetics and you're developing a strain, breed first for survival and then for trait.
Yep.
So this is backwards. They're building first to trait and then they're devolving to survival.
Right. So it's like, you know, if you go looking at it, when, well, 150 years ago, there were probably over 3,000 strains of, we'll just use corn because we mentioned it earlier, in the Americas, right? And if you looked at what now would be the continental 48 United States, the contiguous 48, we're down to ag business probably growing maybe 5 or 6 strains, right? They've bottlenecked it all the way down to that, because what they are doing is they are not growing food anymore.
Yeah.
What they are doing is they're manufacturing a food-like organic substance outdoors on a sterile dirt substrate using chemicals.
Yeah. And that's why I call it hydroponics. It's 40,000 acres of hydroponics.
Right. I literally had somebody who was in the Master Gardener program who was teaching vegetable crop production tell me the only reason for the soil was to keep the plants from falling over. Right? That was because that's the idea behind chemical cultivation. Here's the thing. I have never, in all of the, you know, sciencing I've done about around this, we have never found a nutrient-dense example of food grown using chemical cultivation. And what I mean by chemical cultivation, to be very precise, is you start by saying, okay, we're going to put like NPK fertilizer on this.
Yeah.
Right? And then, well, okay, like you go out right now and you go buy your Bonnie plant from, say, Lowe's or Home Depot, okay? And yeah, I'm naming names. So here we go, right? Okay, you go out and get that and you bring it back. You realize that what happened was, in order to make, in this big, huge set of greenhouses where they get your little tomato seedling or your squash seedling or whatever, right, that they take and they sterilize the dirt that they're going to grow in because they don't want diseases. Their whole theory about avoiding diseases is kill everything.
Sterilize everything.
Sterilize everything. They then put the plant in there and start to grow it, and they put chemicals on it to give it NPK, that sort of stuff. What happens is this plant is barely making it. It is, and what happens is you bring it, you put it in your garden, you start trying to feed it compost and so forth. That plant has already decided epigenetically that it can't depend upon the soil food web in order to get its nutrients. It's already habituated to chemical cultivation. You wonder why.
It was born into scarcity, so it adapted to scarcity. So it can't handle abundance.
Right.
And it's like a cow that's always been fed, you know, feed pellets, and you put them on really great pasture, they can die.
They will die.
Yeah.
Pretty quickly. Yeah. If you don't do it slowly over time.
Yeah.
Same thing. And so a lot of stuff we're talking about here on the plant side is exactly true on the animal side as well. Right. So with chemical cultivation, what happens is the plant gets to the point where it is used to only bringing nutrient up through water solubility. And so we put these water-soluble chemicals in there that brings it up into the plant. That's it. In an ecologically healthy system, most of the nutrient uptake is intermediated between symbiotic relationships between the plant roots and the microbes in the soil. That every nutrient dense bit of food we have ever looked at that would be something that you would want a human to eat, that's what's going on right there. That symbiotic relationship between the soil and the plant. And if you go by your chemical starts, you know, from, you know, your big box places, they'll never be able to get there. They will just, they will be a ceiling to what they'll be able to do. And so what we have to do is we have to actually start the animals and start the plants in ecological cultivation and bring them up that way. And all of a sudden, you have the possibility of real food with nutritional integrity. If you don't do that, never seen food that I would classify as having nutritional integrity grown with chemical cultivation, which means I've never seen it from hydroponics. And I've never seen it from growing on sterile dirt substrate that is fed with chemicals. Just never seen it. There's a limit to how much nutrient you can get into food when you grow it that way.
Yeah, I think it was John Kemp I learned this from, that when a plant germinates, the seed germinates and those root sprouts.
Yes.
The first association that it seeks, it may not find it, but the first association it seeks is mycorrhizal fungi. Right? And if it is really going to get the most benefit from that, it needs to find it right away so that it's like you said, it's epigenetics. And we use terms sometimes that people are like, what the hell are you talking about? On top of genetics, environmentally affected activation of the genes that are underlying. So if you look at two twins and one ate a diet of crap his whole life and the other guy worked out his whole life, and you all want to say, well, the fat guy has worse genetics than the muscle guy. No, the muscle guy activated his epigenetics. So by forming that association that early, there's a lot of epigenetics released in that. And I've seen things like corn that produces reliably and does good, you know, two cobs on a stalk of corn, and you give it good biology, you inoculate it, all of a sudden that same exact genetics is thrown four or five ears that are bigger than the two ears. Mm-hmm. And it's the same genetics, but those epigenetics are now activated. Because, and it's an annual. So the other side of it is, it's what you thought a tree lives 100 years. You're talking about a plant that lives 90 to 120 days. Yep. If it's missing that's like you missing things that your body needs for the first 15 years of your life. Yep. And then you say, why is this guy 30 and sick?
Yeah.
Right. It takes time to recover, and you don't necessarily always have the time. How much damage you did, how much can you recover?
Yeah, there's so many directions to go from that. One of them, just for people who aren't familiar with the difference between genetics and epigenetics, here's kind of how I explain it. Your genetic code, your DNA, is like the cookbook that has all the recipes, and it has all the recipes for all the proteins and associated compounds that you need to be able to produce to be able to be healthy, right? And so there it is. There is the cookbook. And I say, all right, there's your genetics. But if you think about it for a minute, there's a whole piece missing to that, right? It's like I can hand you a cookbook and put it in the kitchen and go, there's all the recipes you need in order to feed everybody. But then you're like, oh, wait a minute. You know, there's a lot more information that needs to be taken into account. Like, which recipe should we make when and how much of it, right? We probably want to make a different set of dishes in the wintertime when it's cold outside than in the summertime when everybody would, you know, appreciate something that's kind of cooling and lighter and so forth.
Sure.
And so epigenetics is the way that our genetics are modified by internal cell processes to take into account a lot of that information. It's like when you go into the cookbook and you put little, earmarks in there and you put little post-it notes in there, say, make this, you know, hey, it's going to be everybody's coming for Thanksgiving. Make these recipes now, right? You can think of that as epigenetics. It's like how much and which of the recipes are the ones we need to be using right now, and how much and why. And that's what our epigenetics are telling us. Now, what happens is as you experience life, your genetics, base genetics, the set of recipes that are in your cell don't change. But what changes is all these marks that go in the cookbook that say, this is what we should be doing to deal with what we're experiencing, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is working. Do more of this. This is not working. Don't do that. And what's interesting we now know is that in genetics, grandparents and parents pass down epigenetic marks to their offspring. So that basically that gives their offspring a head start. It's like, hey, you're probably going to grow up in the same conditions that we grew up in, because that's how, you know, before people were flying all over the place and, you know, you might grow up in a different continent than your parents. Over the history of human beings, the last thousands and thousands of years, you probably grew up right on the same land that your parents and your grandparents and your great grandparents grew up on. Therefore, their genetic experience was probably really good for you to know. And so we have this ability to pass down epigenetic markers so that however your parents and your grandparents lived starts to pass down epigenetic markers to you, which expresses how you decide to deal with the environment you find yourself in. So, you know, what it turns out is it's the exact same thing is true of plants and the exact same thing is true of animals. So if you start breeding plants and you breed them into chemical, nutrient deficient chemical states, they start to epigenetically adapt to at least not dying under those conditions. And then as you continue to propagate those seed lines, they become more and more epigenetically impoverished as well as genetically impoverished. And pretty soon you are running into crisis. On the other hand, if you are working in your community, you're creating really rich soil and you're growing plants and animals on top of that really rich soil, and you are carefully breeding them and you are crossbreeding and everything else we're talking about, you can begin to create genetic biodiversity, but also you can create epigenetics that are very well tuned to where you are growing so that that plant or that animal knows exactly how to thrive, how to deal with disease, how to do all the, you know, how to deal with the climate, how to deal with the humidity, all of that. And so all of those things allow for us to create really highly valuable, very place adapted genetics that we as a community can steward together that will also provide us with nutrient dense food and will be a lot more robust against climate, you know, excursions and around drought and around flooding and around, you know, pests and everything else than anything you could get from the commercial side.
Yeah, and I think one of the other things I've learned from you is that, well, I guess I knew it, but I never really phrased it this way. We have to be an active part of this, or even the best genetics degrade, yes, right? So can you kind of talk about that? Like, if we don't pay attention to the genetics of our livestock and our plants both,
yep,
that no matter how good a job we did, it's a downhill process. Fundamentally, humans are part of nature and nature's evolution. I like to call us co-creators.
Yes, absolutely. So the thing people kind of forget is that the instant you take something and domesticate it, it's the dynamics of how it procreates and breeds and procreates fundamentally shifts, right? So let's talk about it from both sides, the plant side and the animal side. Let's start with plants. Okay. In the wild, if you had a plant that was as nutrient deficient as is grown in the average in big ag setting, nature would fix the problem. And it would fix the problem by sending in aphids and Japanese beetles and all these things. They would be like, oh, look, there's a bunch of sick plants. Let's fix that.
Let's kill them.
Kill them. Yeah. Take it out so something healthier can grow. And so what happens is, because we are growing genetically impoverished plants in a chemical cultivated environment, nature's cleanup crew shows up and says, takes it out. Now, if we start to take and protect, quote unquote, protect those plants from those cleanup crew by poisoning the cleanup crew, then what just happened is nature can't do its normal corrective job of taking out all the bad stuff, right? Therefore, we are allowing the bad stuff to actually procreate, breed, and perpetuate itself where nature would never allow that to happen. So what this means is we take something into domestication, right? Exactly, right? You take something into domestication and you protect it from natural evolutionary pressure, and you let anything breed that wants to breed. Then what ends up happening is you end up with very weakened genetics, because you're letting all the bad stuff, you're not letting it be culled out, right? Same thing is true of livestock. If you take in any form of livestock, poultry, ruminant animals, whatever, you're naturally going to start protecting them from predation, which means that if you don't, or you're not thoughtful about which of those animals you allow to breed, animals will start breeding in your domesticated breeding program that would have never been able to breed in natural environment, because predators and food pressure and everything else would have just taken them out. And what this means is, when you bring any form of animal into domestication, including human beings,
yep,
okay, and you do this, then what happens is you are allowing genetics to go downhill really, really fast. So you have to be very thoughtful when you domesticate anything about what you choose to breed. And you have to choose which plants are allowed to be the ones that you save your seeds from, which ones actually even you allowed to cross-pollinate, right? So one of the things that we do is we rogue out early, right? Somebody I saw just going past said, so blight is good. No, what blight tells you is that particular plant is susceptible to blight in its current
Correct.
Growing condition.
That's what my That's what my answer was, sort of.
Yeah, pull that out. When the blight shows up, the same thing as when the aphids show up. I teach farmers this. When the aphids show up and start eating your crop, be thankful, because what they're doing is they're telling you that you're growing insect food, not mammal food. Okay? This is a whole thing to get into, but when you get your food nutrient dense enough, all those insect pests will actually stop dealing with your crop, right? So the same thing when we're dealing with livestock, it's like one of the early steps in the whole program I lay out for how to do this is we rogue out. We look at the animals that are we've got, and we say, ooh, that phenotype, which is like a phenotype is the fancy way of saying its size, color, shape, you know, feather color, feather type, blah, 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 blah. Whether, say, a chicken has feathers on its legs, right? Like there are certain breeds that have feathers on the legs, but there's other breeds that don't. And what you start realizing is like, oh, if that breed is a breed that was not supposed to have feathers on the leg and they do, that can be an indication of other problems. And so that is not a breeding animal, right? Maybe if, that can be a laying hen, maybe, but we would never let that be a breeding animal because we do not want those genetics. And if we let that animal breed, we're letting that bad genetics get mixed in and spread. And
all, so we got choices with that particular bird. We either have to isolate her when we're taking eggs to hatch, or we have to soup plot her.
Right.
There is a quick one.
Yeah. So what I've ended up doing with a lot of groups who are doing like poultry genetics is we will very carefully select breeding flocks, right? And the breeding flocks are the only ones that are allowed to actually create the next generation. So you can have laying hens that are not part of the breeding flock. And as long as they're good layers, that's fine.
Sure.
You're just not letting those particular eggs hatch and become next generation. You can have animals that become meat birds that, you know, are not part of the next generation. You take those for the pot. And this is the way to look at it, that we in livestock, we carefully select the animals that are our breeding stock, and we do not allow for the genetics of all the rest of the animals to make it down further into our genetic lines. That's what we do with the animals. In the plants, there's another set of strategies, which also involves like roguing out early before you get into cross-pollination so that things that have rogue traits that you really don't want can't actually be involved in cross-pollination and setting seed, right? We don't want those genetics, so we take those out before we get into that. But this is stuff that you have to be thinking about very carefully. If you think about it carefully, you can actually have your genetics get better and better and better. If you don't think about it, your genetics will automatically get worse.
Yeah, it again, we have to be an active part in this, you know. And right. What it makes me think of is Michael Saylor a few years ago did a really long, like, 10-part series with a guy named Robert Breedlove, and it was on Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. But I'd say the first three episodes, I don't care if you don't give a damn about Bitcoin, you should listen to it. I learned so much about engineering, art, history, and warfare and all this stuff from that. But one of the things Saylor said was the reason everything's beautiful is in nature is because when it's no longer prime, it's dead.
Yep.
And we may not like it, but it is.
Yes.
And the reason when you look at the Serengeti and you see 10,000 wildebeest and they are all a picture of health, it's because the first time one stumbles, a lion, a leopard, something gives it the chomp.
Right.
And that's how nature works. And it's one thing to have a heart and like, oh, I want this animal to live and all. But it's another thing to say, I want that animal's genetics or not. Like,
right.
When you say I've got birds that I would never produce a next generation from, but they're making eggs for me. So they're earning their keep. So they're fine, but they're not something I want to make the next generation from.
Right. You know, I'll put it pretty strongly. I'll say this. If you are keeping livestock and you are not culling the livestock genetics the same way top predators would cull, you are being cruel to the future generations of your livestock. Because what you're doing is you are assuring that their genetic health will be compromised.
Correct, correct. And like I said, we can have a heart and still do the same thing. Like, absolutely. I've got an older pecking duck right now that's got some kind of weird thing that I think is genetic and I think it's neural that's caused her feet as she's aged to kind of turn in.
Yep.
I'll never take an egg from her and hatch it.
Right.
But she also, they were adopted ducks. It was like two peckins, a male and a female, that came together 5 years ago, and they have never not been together. I'm not going to whack her because of that, but I'm also not going to let her reproduce.
Yes. So the other thing I just point out really quickly on this is that because of the way most livestock breeding programs go, you actually need to scrutinize your male genetics even more closely than your female genetics.
I know what
you're doing. And that's because it's like, you think about it. Okay, let's just start off. I started off and did a lot of work with breeding chickens, you know, and making and trying to recover chicken genetics. All right. In a breeding flock, we might have, you know, one rooster with 10, 15 hens, which means that coming out of that breeding flock, the rooster's genetics is in every single bird.
Correct.
But the hen's genetics may be in 1/15th of the next generation.
Correct.
So what that means is, boy, you better be careful in choosing that rooster. Right?
Yeah.
And so we spent a huge amount of time being very careful and watchful on the male genetics. The same thing is true in a lot of cases. If you have a breeding bull, that bull may cover a lot.
50 cows, right?
Like, right. Yeah. Which means, again, that bull genetics, that's why prize breeding bulls are so prized.
Freaking 100 grand, 200 right. grand, some of them it's half like, $1 million.
If their genetics are that good that you, it's like, then you've, that's a valuable resource right there, right? And if that bull genetics are bad, you're in trouble.
Big trouble.
Yeah.
Because that genetic code is going to everybody.
Right.
It could even be a negative but recessive trait.
Yes.
You don't even see for two or three generations when the right. two come back together and they're both there, right? Like
yep.
we have some like the bad trait is recessive. So unless you get both and you know, you're never going to get that
yep.
in that first cross if the female doesn't have it, she's not carrying it.
Right.
But you might be three generations down the line before you figure out that you've got a bad male.
Got a bad thing. So there's a saying, and I'll give you the geeky genetic or you know, biological saying is that phenotype is an expression of genotype.
Okay.
Which basically means phenotype is, like I said, it's the size, shape, color, physical attributes of the thing, whether it be an animal or a plant. That's your phenotype. Genotype means the genetic makeup, right? So one of the things that people figured out a long time ago was that they started writing these things called like the standard of perfection for a breed. And this was especially back before the 1940s, before you went into the commercial industrial ag. You had people that were, you know, on homesteads and small farms managing their own genetics, and they needed a guideline they didn't have genetic testing. They couldn't, you know, send it off to the lab at that point in time in the early 20th century to get genetic sequencing to see if there was some sort of nasty genetics hiding in their read lines that they couldn't see. What they learned was that there were sometimes telltales in the phenotype that would warn you that that particular animal had something in its genotype you didn't want. Like in the black Australorps I worked with for a while, some of them would wind up with like one or two white wing feathers, right? Well, that is a hard cull because
okay.
it turns out that if they have those couple little white wing feathers, there's other genetic issues that are associated with that.
Okay.
So what you started realizing is you would get out the standard perfection, you go to your breed, and it would have disqualifiers. It would say, yeah, for this breed, feathers on the leg, disqualifier, this thing or that thing, disqualifier. What that was basically doing, it was learned experience that when you saw that phenotype expression, that thing that popped up that you could physically see, that was a hard no, that you did not want that genetic continuing in your breed lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would make certain that that was not a breeding animal. So this is where going back and finding these older standards, especially like pre-World War II standards, there's some really great information about that in some of those older standards.
So what you're saying is the farmers collectively that noted that and said, this is out. It wasn't so much, I just want my chickens to be black. It's like, when I let this happen, these other bad things came down the line.
Right.
And exactly. therefore this is a red, it's a white feather, but that white feather is a red flag.
Correct. Yeah.
And that may not be true of a different chicken that's mostly black. Like he may yep. show some, or she may show some white coloration, and it's just a color variance in
right.
that breed. But in this breed, this is a hard, absolute, you got to yep. go.
That's right. And so that kind of lived experience, knowledge and experience started to dissipate when we got into commercialized ag after World War II, and we started to basically, bring down from hundreds of different, varietals down to a handful that were used and bred exclusively by these, by breeders, a handful of those different, breeds that were being used over and over and over again. It's like Cornish cross for meat production, right?
Sure.
It's like, so now almost none of the big meat producing meat bird, chicken meat, meat bird producers breed their own chicks. They get deliveries of hatched chicks from a hatchery, and they're all this very genetically bottlenecked Cornish cross thing, right? But what happened because of that, when we started seeing a lot of the other heirloom breeds getting, what happened to them after World War II? Well, a lot of them just fell to hobbyist backyarders. That's the only reason that they kept, but those hobbyist backyarders did not have this knowledge of how to maintain the breeds. They weren't rigorous with their breeding programs. And what happened is I go and look at a lot of what are now called your, heirloom breeds or whatever, and a lot of their genetics have been allowed to really deteriorate quite a bit. They're just a shadow of what they should be. The good news is that with a really focused breeding program, you can bring that back.
And I think part of the problem we have with modern genetics is that we stopped breeding for things like robust, strong survival. We bred for pure productivity.
Right.
Ounces per ounces out per ounces in a feed. Corn kernels out per granules of NPK, right?
Yep.
So you can breed for anything. Doesn't necessarily mean you, like, can you do something? Sure, but does it mean you should do it? Probably not. Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park kind of springs to mind. Like, you were so busy seeing if you could do it, you didn't ask the question about whether or not you should do it. And that's what we've done. We've created these very weak strains, but they're very good at what they do. And this is why I love your work with, like, your PDC is totally different than most. It's designed for engineering type scientific minds, because the problem you kind of started out with in this episode is that we have these people doing these things that are actually damaging the planet, but they're very good at what they do.
Yep.
They're not dumb people, and they're not malicious people. They've been trained, and training and teaching are different. Training is to condition an organism so that it will respond in a specific way. I can train a slime mold. I can't teach a slime. I can teach a human and train a human. I can only train a plant. I can't teach a plant. It doesn't have the cognitive ability. And so, like, when I used to do consulting for marketing and advertising and things like that, so the first thing I would do is analyze the financials of the company, and they would always want to know, like, you're not here for financial line. Well, I need to know if this product actually makes you money.
Yep.
Because if it loses you money, and I am good at what I do, and if I say I'm going to make this thing sell, it's going to sell. If you sell faster, you'll go out of business faster.
Right.
And that's kind of what engineers are doing right now in the world of genetics too. They're evolving the plant to perform poorly biologically, but optimally for capital, from a standpoint of financial capital.
Right.
It's like, and not for the farmer, for them, for the producer of the seed, the producer of the chemical. Their first goal is, I'll make my money and the taxpayers will subsidize the farmer so they won't go. Like, you're a drug dealer that doesn't want to kill your patient, but you want to keep them high.
Yep. Yeah. You just reminded me of the old joke in business of, we're losing money on each unit, but we'll make it up on volume.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly why I would do that.
Yeah.
Because we had the first time I got in, like, just hotshot young guy, like, oh, I'm going to sell a bunch of shit. And all of a sudden this company's in financial trouble. Like, holy shit, what did I do?
Yeah.
Well, I figured they knew whether they were making money or not. And after that, I'm like, I'm never doing this again. They were losing money on every unit.
Right. So, think back, we mentioned the Cornish cross, right?
Yeah.
The Cornish cross could never, chickens are descended from the red jungle fowl out of Asia. The Cornish cross could never survive in that environment. It would be just taken out immediately, right?
Survive in my backyard without protection.
Right. So there are consequences to all of this. Remember, we are oftentimes doing this because we're trying to create food, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we've got a Cornish cross. They've been bred to the point where they can be brought to slaughter weight in 35 days. Okay. Now, for those who haven't got a basis of comparison, before the Cornish cross, back before World War II, the Delaware was a chicken breed that was very commonly used as a meat bird because it would come to slaughter weight, processing weight, quickly compared to other breeds. And that would be like 13 to 14 weeks, right? Now, do the math. 35 days is something like 7 weeks. What you basically have is you have this genetic Frankenbird that becomes obese very, very quickly. Now, and so we have these big fluffy chicken breasts that we can sell to people. That is not without a trade-off. And so I'm going to give you one of many trade-offs. There's this thing called xenohormosis. That's a great one. Xeno means foreign. Hormosis means the effect of hormones. What that basically means is if you get something into your body that your body sees as a hormone, it responds to it. One of those people know about are like pseudoestrogens, right? Like you take in certain things and your body says, oh, that's estrogen. And so you get an estrogen response out of it. Well, it turns out that when you eat plants and when you eat animals, you can get xenohormosis. You do get xenohormosis. You get hormones that come into your body and your body responds to that. Yep. Somebody says soy. Exactly. It's like soy is a pseudoestrogen. Well, it turns out that you can get, when animals become obese, they start to create a whole category of hormones called obesogens. And these obesogens are hormones that basically tell you to do certain things with your metabolism and to store fat and to all kinds of stuff, right? So when we eat an animal that was been bred to be clinically obese at 35 days, you process, you eat the meat, you are eating obesogens, which signal your body to do the same thing. Also, if they're raised in an environment in which is stressful, there will be all these stress hormones that are produced in their body. You eat that, you get the stress hormones. So it's not just, I mean, yes, it is true that it is morally reprehensible to put animals in some of the conditions that an industrial system does. I would absolutely agree with that. But if you think we can do that and then be free from the consequences of doing that, no. When you eat that, you reap the consequences of the way that animals was raised and how that animal's genetics has been stewarded.
And we know this. We know that what an animal, how an animal is treated, how it grows, and what it consumes affects the product that we consume. Yep. No matter how much we try to convince ourselves otherwise. Because the most expensive pork in the world is a black-footed hog that grows in Spain that finishes on acorns.
Yep.
And you can take that exact pig and not finish it on acorns, and it's not going to be that, you know, jamón de la Volta. It's not going to do that.
Yes.
Right? It has to have that feedstock as part of its process to become what it has evolved into in combination with man's management. So right. If the good can come through, if, you know, Mark Shepherd's chestnut finished hogs taste differently than a hog that's finished on corn, then if we have all this negative stuff, stress hormones, obesity hormones, all this stuff going on in the animal, then that's going to manifest in us and we're consuming that too.
Right.
You know, I mentioned Ken Berry when you were talking about that. I'm like, Ken Berry needs to hear this.
Yep.
But when we look, you know, we look at that, one of the things he explains about like getting your diet right is it's hormones that make the difference. If you take 2 9-year-olds that are the same height and you silhouette them from behind, you can't tell male from female.
Yep.
But if they're 18, you can look at a silhouette from behind, just blacked out, and you go, girl, boy. Well, what told that female to put more on the hips and the breast than the male? Hormones. So hormones are a very important component to our system. We have a whole system that is regulated and uses our hormones to regulate our body systems, right? But you put the wrong ones in there, you can jack everything up to hell. And you look at all this, and it's no surprise that most people walking around are deficient in vitamin D, which is not a vitamin, it's actually a hormone, just as one example.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things, you bring this up about being able to tell male from female from a rear silhouette.
Yeah.
There's actually really hard science on that, where what they did is they took pictures. So let's give another scientific term. Secondary sexual characteristics is what you're referring to.
Okay? Yeah.
So secondary sexual characteristics mean that a hormonally balanced female will begin to develop wider hips, you know, and mammary glands and so forth when they go through puberty in preparation to be able to take on the biological role of female of giving birth and nursing young, right? Males typically, when they go past puberty, start to develop wider shoulders, that classic V taper, mm-hmm. more upper body mass and muscle and so on and so forth. Okay. So a long time ago, they did this experiment where they took silhouetted pictures from behind of males and females. You couldn't, they pulled hair up if the hair was longer and only showed from the neck down with mm-hmm. them standing with their arms outreached and so forth. So you could see this. And they had nurses and doctors attempt to, and these are black and white silhouette pictures.
Yeah.
Like, is this a male or a female? Now, teenagers, say 16, 17, and 18, who have had time to develop secondary sexual characteristics back in the 40s, 50s, and even into the 60s, doctors and nurses could tell the difference with a pretty good amount of, you know, high correlation, male to female. They could tell the difference. Where we are today is you can take 16, 17, and 18-year-olds, do the same experiment, and doctors and nurses now have a hard time telling the difference because the hormonal soup that we're growing up in has basically created a mix where the secondary sexual characteristics are not being expressed. And the fact is, the secondary sexual characteristics, in order to fully develop that, they develop best when you have high nutrient density food. It's the same reason that everybody says, oh, you got to pull all your teeth out because you have extra teeth in your head. It used to be 200 years ago when everybody had enough nutrient in their food, your dental palate developed beautifully and widely and all your teeth came in straight.
Yeah.
Right? Weston A. Price documented that really, really well. Today, what's happening is people have so much nutrient deficiency in their food that even their dental palate grows in narrow and they have extra teeth and they come in all crooked.
Yeah, because why the hell would the human evolve a set of teeth that are not only not useful, but actually problematic?
Right.
That would not happen. That's not how evolution works.
That's right. Now, there's doctors that, one of the things that's kind of interesting, and there's a little story, I believe, in one of Sally Fallon's cookbooks where she talks about a doctor who had been delivering babies for something like 60 years. And one of the things he noted, this was back, I guess, in the 1990s when this was written, that when he first started, he had never found a female who could not easily provide vaginal delivery and vaginal birth because the secondary sexual characteristics, the broad hips, allowed for them to easily dilate and deliver. Now we're getting to the point where upwards of half of the young women the OBGYN looks at them and says, I don't think you can actually vaginally deliver. Hmm. I think we're going to have to do a C-section because your hips are literally not able, the way you're structured, we don't think you can actually deliver naturally. This shows you what the downstream impacts are of everything we're doing, both with the food systems and with the chemical pseudo hormone mess that we're actually raising our children in today.
Yeah, and it seems like it's kind of a genetic and epigenetic thing, right? So it's epigenetic because the nutritional deficiencies are causing the palate issues and let's say the ability to deliver a child. But it's also the fact that we are, and people are going to take me as being heartless when I say this, we're enabling it.
Right.
And that we're allowing a woman to reproduce that maybe genetically does have a defect that now is going to be passed on. So the two are coming together. And I'm not saying we should be telling anybody whether to have kids or right. not. We need more kids right. than we have. But that's a fundamental reality that at least we need to stay in touch with when we're talking about dealing with a cow or a sheep. Right.
Well, like, let's look at it this way, Jack. It's like if you were had a breeding program for cows and you got to the point where half of the cows that you were breeding could not actually deliver young without surgical intervention, would you scratch your head and say, maybe there's something wrong here?
Yeah. Yeah.
But we have exactly that happening in the human population. And we're like, yeah, what you gonna do?
Yeah. 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 I think that's really interesting. Can you maybe talk about how we actually have to have like a symbiosis of partnership with microbes though in all of this? Like I can give you the best seed that I have.
Yep.
And you can live down the road from me. So we're not even changing bioregions. We're not changing climate. We're not changing soil base type.
Yep.
But if you haven't done the work that I've done with biochar, with biological composting, with mycorrhizal fungi, if you haven't built up the biology, my great genetics are not going to look that great on your property. And I would think that's true of livestock and mammals and birds too, because we all have relationships to biology. When I did my bioreactor compost course, it part of the research I did so I could develop that material, basically it was from Dr. Johnson. It was a diagram of a human body.
Yep.
And it showed what portion of your body is human and what part is, you know, microbiology. And basically your knee on one side down to your foot is how much of you is human. The rest of you is microbiology.
Yep.
So we need that.
What's interesting there is that there's a number of cells and then there's biomass. So let's look at it like that. Human cells are really big compared to the bacteria. Okay.
Yeah, that might be misleading, but yeah.
So if you were to go counting and you were to go look at a human being and you were to count, let's count all the living cells in this thing. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right, so forth. And you count all of them. You count all the human cells and you count all the bacteria. You count all the yeasts and fungi. You count so on and so forth. What you would find out is that the bacteria and the other microbes outnumber the human cells dramatically.
Yeah, somewhere in the neighborhood of like 10 to 1.
10 to 1. Now, on the biomass side, if you were to somehow take it all apart and put all of the human cells in a pile over here and all of the biology, other microbes in a pile over here and dry it down what we call dry weight, like get all the water out of it and just see how much dry weight is left, it would be something like the average human would probably have 4 to 6 pounds of microbes in them. Okay? Now, here's the thing. Let's do a thought experiment and say we took a human being and we somehow had a magic wand and could remove all of those microbes from that person. Just like, boom. Okay. Had a magic Star Trek transporter. We put you through the transporter.
Right?
It separated them out in the tube. Like, you are still you. All of your cells are still perfectly in where they were. But now there's a little pile of microbes over here on the side. You would not survive that at all. That would kill you very, very quickly. The reason is that immediately something like 70% of your immune system is gone. And your ability to digest food just completely went away. And all these other things. So it is much better to think of yourself as a consortium of different species than it is to think of yourself as one species. And there's a word for this. Remember, I teach a lot of engineers and scientists and so forth, so I bring out all the words for this.
Yeah.
The word is holobiont. It basically is what you would think of as one core species, like a tree or a cow or a human, and then a lot of other thousands or tens of thousands of other species that actually have come into collaboration with that species so that that species, like a multicellular organism, big multicellular organism, can live. So you take a tree and take all its microbial symbiotes away from it, it'll die. You take a cow, take its microbial symbiotes away from it, it'll die very fast because we're very familiar with that. The rumen, everything that's going on in the rumen is a bioreactor with all this biology in it, right? So the cow can't even begin to process food without those symbiotes in its rumen. And we're the same way. We have to have that. And what's interesting, by the way, so we talked about C-sections versus natural delivery. How do you think the gut of a mammal gets primed? Because up until the time a mammal is born, its gut is pretty uncolonized by these microbes. It's actually part of natural delivery that when the amniotic fluid, you move to the amniotic fluid, it gets pushed in the nose and the mouth.
Yes.
That goes down, and that is where you get the initial priming of your gut microbiome. And if you miss that, you come out of your mom with a blank slate, and all kinds of nasty things can move in. So one of the things that I insist when I have people that are asking, they're saying, I'm going to have to do a C-section delivery. It's like, you better find an OBGYN who understands that when they do that, they need to take a vaginal swab.
Okay.
And actually take the vaginal swab and inoculate the nasal
cavities. Sure.
And the oral cavities of the infant as soon as they are born in order to get, because you will miss a lot of critical microbes, including especially the bifidos. The bifido families are ones that are really hard to get any other way. And if you don't have those, you have problems. And by the way, here's another little side note for you. A lot of autism is either created by this or is actually made worse by this. This is one of the reasons we're seeing so much autism today.
So here's another question then. What happens when mom was born that way and grandma was born that way and no one ever, even if you did the swab or even if you had a natural birth, it's not there.
Right. Correct. You realize what happens is today that there are gut maladies for the only way they've been able to solve them long term is by what they call a fecal matter transplant.
Yep. Yep.
They go find a person who has good, healthy gut flora, and they literally harvest that flora and transplant them into you. And it's really amazing that this has instantly solved problems for people who've had gastroenterological and other kinds of immune system problems for decades. Right?
Yeah.
So understand that you are a holobiont and that the animals you're working with are a holobiont, and even the plants that you are working with are holobionts, is critical. So when we start looking at genetic capital, it's like, yeah, we want to focus on, well, that's the cow or that's the sheep or that's the, you know, potato plant or that's the whatever. And as long as I've got the seed of the plant of the, you know, the lettuce or the seed of the squash plant, I've got it. Or if I've got if I can breed a cow, I've got it. And the answer is, well, no, because that animal or that plant can only be optimally healthy if they have the right consortium of microbes with which to partner. And if that's deficient, then you got a problem. So one of the things we looked at in seed saving is if you take seeds and you dry them down and you put them in freezer storage for a long time, are you actively storing the microbiology? Did that microbiology successfully get onto the cover of that seed, right? And was that successfully kept through your storage program? Or does the soil that you planted into have all of those in abundance? They can recolonize, right? Or is there a wild reservoir of all of this? One of the things we saw that just lit a bell for me was like listening to some indigenous people talk about how they saved the seed corn. And when they got ready to plant the seed corn, they would do this weird thing. They would go out and they would harvest certain plants and they would make this water slurry, and they would do all this stuff, and then they would take that the resulting liquid, and they would soak the seeds in that liquid for a little bit before planting them.
That's the Iroquois corn medicine.
Yes, it's corn medicine. And you realize, oh my God, what they're doing is they're going and they're finding plants that are in the same family as the corn that have this, if they're growing wild and they're healthy, they have all the microbial symbiotes. They're making a extract,
yeah,
right? And then they're soaking the corn seeds in the extract to make certain that they are coated with their microbial symbiotes and then planting them.
They're getting the ectophytes and the endophytes into that plant from, like you said earlier, from the moment that plant germinates, it's germinating into an abundance environment. So it's going to grow abundantly,
right,
versus grow scarcely, because it's going to grow scarcely. Like, if you want to make, I'm not saying to do this before anybody goes out and does it, but if you want to make your fruit tree fruit the first year, prune the shit out of it and stress the hell out of it.
Mm-hmm.
It'll make some fruit right away because it thinks it's going to die.
Right.
And it's going into survival of the species mode.
Right.
So it will instantly, that's why you'll have, you know, two people growing something that notoriously bolts like cilantro.
Yep.
Right. And it's not that hot yet. The one shoots up and bolts and goes to coriander immediately. And the other one holds till summer. Well, one stressed more than the other. It's that stress that says thou must reproduce or thou shall be exterminated, right?
Right.
What is the permaculture principle? That an organism reproduces most abundantly when it is in an abundant state or an extermination state.
Right.
Right. Those both cause high level of reproduction.
Right. One of the things that's interesting when you look at it from a seed production standpoint is that if you're in survival mode, that typically what happens is the plant is not even in full photosynthetic efficiency, right? And if you look at John Kemp's pyramid, I really love that because he says, okay, down here, the plant is trying to get the full photosynthetic efficiency. If it can do that, it still has, you know, the next level up of health is full protein expression. It'll get to be able to create all the proteins at once. If it can get to that, the next level of health is full lipid expression, where it can get all the fats that it wants. And this is why when you see a plant that is really healthy, it can have that really, you know, that sheen on the leaf. Those are lipids that helps it hold in. So you can actually like physically see, in some cases, Hybrix plants, because you can look at the leaf color and the sheen on the leaf, right? And then the highest level of health in a plant is plant secondary metabolite expression. The plant can create all the plant secondary metabolites it needs. If you have a plant there, that's amazing. What you see is when it sets seed, it has everything it needs to put everything in the seed at once. It produces big, healthy, beautiful seeds with this like wax coating on them.
Yeah.
Right? That's what you want. That's a healthy plant with a healthy seed. If they're in that, you know, as you said, survival mode, just try to make certain the species doesn't die out. They're typically going to have not let the same amount of energy. They're not going to have all the lipids. They're going to produce smaller seeds. They're going to be dull in color, and they're not going to have that glossy finish. And they might even have cracks on the surface.
Yeah.
So when we're looking to the seeds we want to save, they're big, they're beautiful colored, they've got the glossy finish, and they don't have cracks.
Yeah.
That's one of the things we're looking for. And we want plants that are growing in harsh conditions that still do that. That's the plant. Those are the seeds that we go after.
Yeah, I mean, like you look at a plant like cowpea, one of the reasons it's a great cover crop is it's something called extrafloral nectaries. So it actually will produce nectar from the leaf. And this year, just on an experiment based on something I heard from John Kemp, who you just mentioned, I threw like 9 Red River cowpeas right into a fairly mature bioreactor, but it was still aging.
Yep.
And it produced, like, I've got like a quart jar full of Red River from 9 plants, which is insane, because if anybody out there has never, like, this is not the black-eyed pea you buy in a store. They're about a third of the size. That's a lot of seed from 9 plants. But it would produce, and then you'd pick it, and it would flower and produce again. And in the interim where there's no flowers, I go out there one day, and there's freaking bees everywhere.
Yeah.
But it's the middle of the day when nothing else is in flow, and I go in, and the bees are just, like, it looked like half a swarm in this one bioreactor.
Yep.
And I realized how much ectofloral nectar this plant was growing, but it was growing in like pure bioreactor compost.
Yes.
Yeah. And when I pulled it out, there was no rhizomial bacteria at all. There were no nodules at all on this plant because there was no rhizomic bacteria in that compost.
Right.
But it didn't matter. I've never seen a cowpea grow like that in my life. I've never seen a yield like that in my life. And it was because it had everything that it needed. And it, I guess instead of a bacterial association, it was probably fungal out the yin yang that those plants were relying on.
Yeah. So just for people who haven't seen this, there are plants that are what we would call early succession, mid succession, late succession plants.
Okay.
The early succession would be like the most early succession, your pioneer species, what people sometimes call weedy species.
Mm-hmm.
These tend to have the most symbiotic relationships with bacteria because in early succession, bacteria is what's present. So plants that are well adapted to pioneer conditions oftentimes have a lot of symbiotic relationships with bacteria. As you start to go forward in succession to mid-succession, and by the way, a lot of our garden plants are somewhere around mid-succession, they have symbiotic relationships with both bacteria and fungi. By the time you get to late succession, the climax forest, like here in eastern United States where I am, it's the coniferous forest, right? That's very fungally dominant. The plants have a lot of association with fungi. What's interesting, by the way, is the brassica family is the family among the crops that we tend to grow in a garden that are a little earlier succession.
Yeah.
They prefer bacterially dominated slightly to fungally. So it's like if you get really fitsy with it, you can actually make the brassicas happier by being a little more bacterially dominant. That we can get into creating compost and everything that really poke at exactly where we want to go. And by the way, if we get the bacterial to fungal ratio in the soil right, your weed problem goes away because we don't have the germination conditions for the weeds anymore. So the way we fight, so here's the thing, the way we get rid of the weeds is we stop creating the germination conditions for the weeds. And plowing is how you create germination conditions for weeds. So we just don't do that anymore. And we get the soil to mid-succession and all of a sudden, you can have all these weed seeds in there and they just don't germinate because it's not their germination conditions. Now, if you were to come along and plow, immediately you've created the germination conditions. Here come all your weeds again, right? What you call weeds. So that's part of it. Now, the other thing is like, well, how do we deal with the pests? Well, here's the thing. You talked about your cowpea being able to create all this extra floral nectary. What we measure is, in order to figure out, like as a proxy for how healthy the plant is something we call leaf Brix, B-R-I-X, Brix. And it is a measure of the amount of dissolved solid in the sap of the plant, right? So a really unhealthy plant will have super watery sap. There'll be almost nothing in it. You'll take a leaf. You'll extract a drop of sap, you'll put it onto a refractometer, you look at it, and you'll go like, there's no dissolved solids in that almost at all. The Brix will be like 1 or 2, which represents 1 to 2% dissolved solids. That plant is barely hanging on. And by the way, that's what we see in almost all commercial ag plants, a Brix of 1 to 2, maybe 2.5. They're barely hanging on. Their sap is super watery. They don't have any of the nutrients they need. They're in survival mode. That's it, right? Okay. And these are the plants that every insect pest will go after. It's like a beacon on the landscape. They can literally smell it. They all come in because that plant has no defenses and it's unhealthy and it's insect food and the insects do their job of eating it up and taking it out of the environment. Now, if you start to get the plant more healthy and you get it to the point where it can do full photosynthetic efficiency and it starts to be able to get into all its proteins, the Brix starts to go up. You get a Brix of like 4 to 6 and now the aphids can't eat it anymore. The aphids stop bothering it. You don't have to worry about aphids. You go up to a Brix of about 6 to 8. Now you're what we call the sucking insects. The ones that have a proboscis that suck, they stop. You go up to about a 8 to 10, and your chewers, your Japanese beetles, and all of your things that tend to chew, your caterpillars and everything, go away. When you get to a leaf bricks of 10, you have the plant that healthy, nothing touches it except grasshoppers and locusts. And by the time you get to 12 to 14 of leaf bricks, they stop. Literally, by the time you get to a leaf bricks of 12 to 14, you have stopped growing insect food. They will literally come look at it and go, nope, we can't eat that, and go away. Now you're growing mammal food. Now what you're doing is, in your garden, instead of fighting to keep the insects out, you're fighting to keep every mammal out, because now you're growing mammal food, right? And so I tell farmers is, you're not growing human food if you're growing insect food.
Mm.
That's a paraphrase of Dan Kittredge, by the way, from the Bionutrient Food Association. I got that concept from him, so I want to give him credit for that. But that helped me reframe as we were doing all of this and realizing that we could also associate that with something you can measure with a really inexpensive little thing in your own garden. And we can use this to decide how good of a job we're doing. And I learned the bricks stuff from Kay Baxter down in New Zealand, doing a food security course with her. And here's the thing. She'll pull anything out of her garden with leaf bricks of less than 10. She says, that's not human food. We're not growing that. And people have shown up at Kawanga Institute down there, eaten nothing but the food from Kawanga for 6 to 8 months, and reversed even insulin-dependent diabetes. So, you know.
So I've heard that before, and this is what I've always wanted to ask you about that. Yeah. If a person listening to this goes out and buys a refractometer, even doing fairly decent practices, and goes out and tries to emulate that, their garden's going to be gone.
Yep.
Right? Like, that's something you have to build to.
Build to.
Right? That's so right. How does the person that goes out there and they get a reading of like a 5 or halfway yep. there, yep. how do they get to the 10 before they start yanking everything out of the ground? Because yep. you have to work with what you have. Working with nature exactly. also assumes that whatever you have is your base, and then you have to right. build from there.
Right. You got to get there. Exactly yeah. right. You got to get there. So one of the things there was a professor here that I was working with, a biology professor, who got really interested in this. So what we did is we did an experiment scientifically. His grad students set this up. Multi-plots all in the same area.
Yeah.
And we decided what we would do is we would do A plots and B plots and C plots. So we have control plots where there was no fertility management done. There were B plots in which all the fertility and everything was normal ag. That is, chemical fertilizers, pesticides, herbicides. They were all hand applied very carefully. And then there was a third group of plots, C plots. Same seed mix, everything else. It was done using compost, aerated compost tea, and so forth only. Okay. No conventional ag. I went out and looked at that 3 weeks in to the first growing season. What we saw was these were coming from the same seeds, right? So it wasn't better genetics or whatever, same genetics. The brassicas in the aerated compost tea and compost were this big. The conventional were that big. The ones in the conventional, there were insects eating on them a lot. The ones in the compost and aerated compost tea, right next to it, literally 10 by 10 plots right next to it, almost no insect predation already. Okay? So the thing is, just by going and starting good soil management and using compost, aerated compost teas, and so forth, even in your first growing season, using only mediocre genetics, you can get your leaf bricks up considerably. We looked at the leaf bricks on the conventional, 1 to 2. We looked at the leaf bricks on the plants that were done with compost, aerated compost tea, already up to a 4 and 4.5.
Okay.
So what you want to do is start there and then watch what you're able to get. Yeah, in the very beginning, you're still going to have insect pests coming in and so forth. Start to work with it, improve your soil, improve your genetics. And then what you want to do is you want to build to the point that Kay has gotten after many years, which is, yeah, our soil is now so great and our genetics is so great that we think of anything with the leaf bricks under 10 as just, you know, not even something we wanted to bother with, because everything in our garden is so high quality. It takes time to get there, but there is a path, and the only path I know of to get there is ecological cultivation like that.
Yeah. So would you say that maybe a strategy might be something like this then? The guy goes out, plants his garden, gets a refractometer, goes through and samples everything.
Yep.
And he's got his top performing stuff is about a 5.
Yep.
And then so maybe he goes in at like anything that's like 3 or lower, that gets yanked that year.
I'd say like and 2 then, or lower for a first pass.
What's that?
2 or lower first pass, yeah.
So as your top keeps coming up, your coal comes down because you have to build that soil. The soil in my – I've got raised beds here that are about 5 years old, and the soil that's in there now is nothing like this. The soil I put in there was shit because it's what I could get. I have no soil I can harvest. I have to bring in material. So I brought in industrial compost and topsoil because that's what I could get. And now that soil bears no resemblance to where I started.
Exactly.
But that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
Can we just talk a little bit there then about how people can maybe, because like I said, I like things people can do.
Yep.
So can you give maybe 2 examples, one with plants and one with animals, of what somebody could do right now to start developing genetics that are solid in their own backyard?
Yeah. I think the first thing is, like we said, we're dealing with holobionts, so it means you need all of the microbial workforce there. And so this is where compost, biochar helps, because biochar provides, you know, a lot of the structure. Even in poor soils, it provides a lot of the, it helps get the structure moving. So if you can start working with biochar and compost and doing it right, and you have to do it right, because I see a lot of people do compost wrong and make it anaerobic, and that actually takes you backwards, right? But if you can do, you know, and I think, Jack, this is probably, I mean, I've noticed you're doing courses on things like the bioreactor and biochar and so forth. It's almost like you're thinking about how to get people off the ground, and that's exactly right. It's like start with the soil, because it's almost impossible to grow, it is impossible to grow healthy plants and healthy animals on top of dirt.
Yeah, I mean, I call it my 3 C's, compost, cover, and char.
Yes.
That's the foundation of what I teach, yeah.
Absolutely agree with that. That's right, cover crop, because living roots in the soil basically start to feed the microbiology. It's like we get these little solar panels up there, harvesting the sunlight, putting exudates into the soil. It starts to really feed the soil food web, right? The biochar helps to physically provide a jump start, provide structure, it provides habitat, it provides, you know, CEC, if your CEC is, it provides a lot of stuff like this, right? And so it that's in there. And then the compost is your biological inoculum. So I people are like, oh, I'm not adding enough compost to be able to put all the nutrients in. I'm like, the nutrients you add when you add compost are about this much of what you're getting.
Yeah.
What you're doing with compost and aerated compost tea and compost extract is you are using it as a biological inoculum to get the good biology in place. To me, it's like people who are used to being in the kitchen, I say it's like adding the sourdough starter to your sourdough, right? You're like, well, how could sourdough starter do anything? It's just water and flour, right? It's like, what's growing in there, that consortium of microbiology in the sourdough starter is the magic. When you take a little bit of sourdough starter and you put it into your dough, what you're doing is you're introducing all that biology into the dough, then it starts to reproduce, and now it colonizes the entire body of the dough, of your sourdough, and you have beautiful sourdough bread, right? Same thing you're doing with compost, aerated compost tea. With your compost, we can apply this on the top, right? And that gets the biology in there. If we do a compost extract, we can drench the soil, and this actually helps carry the microbiology down into the soil a little deeper. And where the aerated compost teas are best is when you are doing foliarly spraying. You're spraying it on the leaves and the stems of the plant. Because when you do that, you're getting that good microbiology to actually grow on all those surfaces. When you are doing chemical cultivation, the only way to keep anything bad from showing up is to poison it. That's why as soon as you do chemical cultivation, there's now pesticides and herbicides and fungicides and all the biocides.
Yeah.
when we do ecological cultivation, the way we keep the bad guys from showing up is we get all the good guys so well established everywhere, they outcompete all the bad guys. Scientific name for that is competitive exclusion. So when you're spraying really good aerated compost tea on the leaves of your plants or your trees, you know, whatever, you're getting really good biology on the leaves. Next thing you know, the bad fungi can't get in there. Therefore, you don't have to have, you don't get fungal blight and stuff like that on your leaves of your plant, right? We're using competitive exclusion instead of nuclear warfare by trying to biocide everything.
Yeah.
You in chemical cultivation. So start there. Build your soil. Once you have the soil, now you have the preconditions. What's interesting, it's part of a three-part cycle, right? Soil, plants, and livestock. Because the livestock and the plants help you build the soil fertility, right? So you have all these nutrient cycles going on, growing the plants, cover crops, and then production crops. If you're doing it properly, they are feeding the soil and they are building the soil microbiology. The soil microbiology is then assisting the plants to be healthier, right? Same thing with the animals. The animals are eating off the land. If you're doing what you should be doing, which is growing a lot of your own feed and fodder on site, then the soil is feeding the plants feed the animals. The animals' manure comes back into the cycle and it continues to build the fertility. By working all three of these systems together, that is the fastest way of generating nutrient-dense real food starting from dirt. Those are the three components to doing that.
Agreed. And I think that the biochar thing is something that we're only just beginning to understand. The way I always describe it is it's like the coral reef in the soil.
Yes.
One of my favorite places in the world, a place called Sanibel Island in Southwest Florida. And they put this causeway out, or the original causeway, back in the late 70s. And eventually they realized they made a big mistake because there's a lot of ship traffic through there as a drawbridge.
Yeah.
So they put a new causeway and then they ripped this. This is miles long. This is a lot of concrete. And they're like, well, now that we're tearing down the old one, what do they do with it? So they put it on barges. They took it about 7 miles offshore and they dropped it. The first year, not jack diddly really happened. You start to get a little bit of activity because any structure in the ocean. But, you know, today, if you're a fishing guide and you do offshore, you actually go out into the ocean. It's one of the first places that they'll go.
Absolutely.
You go out there and there's 10 boats floating around the on the water boat show. Mm-hmm. Over that reef, because that reef is teeming with freaking life now.
Right.
There's snapper and grouper and trigger fish and everything. And then you've got all the other non-reef fish then relate to that biology.
Exactly.
And that's what biochar is. It's like mm-hmm. taking that rubble and putting it into the soil. Now, you should inoculate it. I start mine as high as I can in the system. It goes
yep.
manure management, compost, and then into the
yep.
into yep. the land, right?
Yep.
And so the life's already there. Because if the thing about that is if you stick it in the ground before you do anything with it, it will start using all its wonderful properties and taking up and retaining and holding on a nutrient.
Right.
And it will take two or three seasons before you really get a benefit. And you might season one get a negative. But on the animals too, like I feed it.
Yep.
I put about twice a week, I put a cup of biochar into my feed for my animals and it goes in their bedding and I know they eat it out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's yep. putting it as high as that's
yep.
permaculture water management. Where do you put your first pond?
Yep.
As high in the land as you can. It's the same process.
I agree with that. I think the thing to you know, for people who are thinking about and say, oh, I have really terrible dirt I'm starting with. The worse your dirt is, the more likely that biochar can be helpful.
Agreed.
Because if you get extremely, like, say, sandy soil, it's like, oh, it won't hold any water. It's not structured and so forth. The biochar can help with that. Or you're like, I got really heavy clay soils that, like, just compact, and the biochar can help. I've got really silty soils that are really, you know, like, it's like the biochar can help with that.
Yeah.
It's like, so, you know, if you've got any of those really outliers, you know, very clay, very sandy, very silty or whatever, biochar can be something to experiment with and see exactly what it does, but it's probably going to be really, really good. it's like, as you said, it's the condominiums you put in there for all the good life.
Yep.
It's structures. Interestingly, one of the other ways that I've been doing a lot of stuff with biochar recently has been with bioremediation.
Yes.
Because I'm involved with bioremediation in Maui and with Lahaina fires, but also in Western North Carolina right now. And so when you put biochar in your garden, once it gets into the soil, you'd like for it to be what we call fully charged, which is like, it's got all these nutrients in it, it's got all this life in it and so forth. But when we use it for bioremediation, especially like emergency response bioremediation, we create something I call thirsty biochar.
Absolutely.
So what it is it's not fully charged. So when you put it down, it tends to grab a hold of pollutants and immobilize them. And then all the good, so I'm like filled expedient. So like in Western North Carolina, I'm like, they got all of this downed wood, storm felled wood. And then the North Carolina Department of Transportation was just like trying to pull it together and burn it in big piles.
Yeah.
Okay, stop. What we're going to do is we're going to get big ring of fire biochar rings, the big, huge ones.
Kelpie stuff, like, right?
We're going to take that. We're going to do a burn and create biochar, right? Then we're going to quench it. And then at the very end of the quench, when it's just down to almost ambient, we're going to charge it with a compost extract. Now,
Okay. Agreed,
compost extract is not as good to charge it with as a compost tea. However, we're out in the field. And you can make a compost extract in a 5-gallon bucket.
Yep.
You can get some water. You can bring some compost in the thing. You put it in a bag. Toot, toot, toot. And now what you can do is you can get a big, huge thing of biochar and inoculate it with a compost extract. It's not as ideal as if we put it in a temperature-controlled kiln and got it exactly right and then did an air. But we're trying to do square miles here, right?
Yeah, I got you.
So we take that, we break that down, we put that down as a base layer on this contaminated mud and silt and everything. Then we take a huge industrial chipper shredder, bring it in behind, chip and shred, and create wood mulch and spread it on top.
Oh, right? Okay.
Right. Now we brew an aerated compost tea back at the center and come through a couple days later with a spray truck
and spray your fence.
Spray on top of that. That is what I call my first pass emergency response.
Okay.
Right? We're not, because it's winter time, we're not able to get living roots in the ground as effectively right now. So I'm like, all right, what we're going to do is we're going to do biochar, wood mulch, aerated compost tea, boom.
Yeah.
Let that overwinter. Now, because we're talking about square miles, what do we do in the spring? We are looking at a 8-species phytoremediative plant mix to hydroseed over top of it.
Okay, that's great.
So what we do is we actually hydroseed, but in the hydroseeding mix, we include the biological inoculum so that all the plants have all the biology they need. We get those phytoremediated plants out there and we let them get their roots in the ground and start to go to it, cleaning up the rest of the mess, right? Now, what's interesting about this is I'm talking to organic farmers like Billy Bond and everything over there.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh my God, we already know how to do all of this. Cause it's like exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It turns out if you know how to build soil, you're 90% of the way there to being able to bioremediate soil when it's contaminated.
Agreed. And I actually think that the extract is the way to go most of the time anyway.
Yeah.
And I'm coming very much from Dr. Johnson's school of thought on that is we make this bioreactor compost and we have 400 to 600 species.
Yep.
And that's actually a low ball number because that's not even counting the subspecies when we metagenetically analyze it. And when we make
it strains actually in a
Right. Yeah. So when we make a tea,
yeah,
and we actually aerate it long term and we feed it sugar and we blow the population up, we disproportionately expand the population to those organisms in that compost that like to be wet, oxygenated, and given sugar. Right. So that throws off the balance. When we make an extract, we just kind of knock it loose.
Yep.
And we spread that. So we put the greatest diversity out. And in the application you're talking about, you're not really sure exactly what you need.
Yep. Exactly
so
right.
Growing diverse and then giving it, like you said, giving that in the biochar.
Yep.
You're going to find whatever niche that microbe needs,
mm-hmm.
it exists on the outside, the end, somewhere in
right.
there. And
yep.
I think one of the other things people get freaked out about when you talk about using biochar for remediation, well, yep. it's going to take up these nasties. Well, now it's yep. going to be there permanently. Well, first, and you correct, you're more scientific than me, so you correct anything mm-hmm. I get wrong here. First, that attraction to the biochar is very powerful. It's very strong.
Yes.
And for that plant to get it is an energetic effort. It has to
right.
put effort, kind of like gluconeogenesis in the human body. Protein can become carbohydrate, but it only does yep. it based on how much carbohydrate you need.
Right.
It won't take more than it needs because it takes energy to get it out.
Yes.
And so it takes energy to get it off of there. And then the other thing is a lot of those nasties, let's call them that just for the mm-hmm. common man term, they will be broken down over time by the good biology. So they're held in place. So
yes.
it's like staking something out in the desert so the vultures can eat it.
Yep.
Right.
That's,
like
that's actually true. Yes. And so a couple of things are true there. One of them is yes, they'll get pulled in place. What's interesting is that when I talk about bioremediation, one of the things we talk about is immobilization. And there's a couple different ways immobilization can happen. One of them is that when you get bacteria and fungi working together, they'll start to create soil organic matter. And they have this thing, Jeff Lawton calls it locking it up in carbon prison. And what will happen is that they'll take things. He figured this out in the Jordan Desert with all the salts. Like, where did all the salt go to? Well, what happened was the bacteria and the fungi didn't like the salts. So they started building soil organic matter. They actually locked up the salt inside of the soil organic matter long chain carbon compounds, so they were chemically inert, right? So they're still there, but they are not they're not biochemically reactive. Okay, so there's that. One of the things about like making an aerated compost tea versus a compost, real quick, is this: a compost extract is this. When you do like when I'm doing an aerated compost tea, we have different brews we do according to our target. So yeah, if you feed sugars to an aerated compost tea, you will explode the bacterial population because the bacteria are things that love to metabolize the sugars. I never add simple sugars into any aerated compost tea.
Okay.
I do. I don't do any of it because you don't need it. If you're feeding the fungi, then the bacteria can get what they need as well. We did a lot of experiments, and I have some mixes that we did with Dr. Cheka, who is a PhD biologist here, for how to create fungally dominated aerated compost teas. The advantage of going to all that trouble is that the fungally dominated aerated compost teas, the fungi create during that brew cycle a lot of glomalin compound,
okay.
which are a gluey compound. So the aerated compost tea is stickier.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So if you go to all the trouble of creating a really, what Dr. Lang Ingham calls a biocomplete compost, and then you create a fungally dominated aerated compost tea out of it, you get a pretty biodiverse thing, but it's pretty sticky.
Mm.
So that, if you're going to go to all that trouble, that's when you use it for foliar application.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. And that's why I'm saying when I'm in the field and I'm trying to just get, you know, large scale done, it's like, don't worry with it. Just do a compost extract and get your biochar started that way, because even if you don't get optimal amounts of biology in place, as long as you get enough, the biology will reproduce in situ to produce what you need.
Well, like you said, the foliar concept there is huge, because when you got that stickiness, you got
yep.
those biogels. When you
yep.
spray the leaf, especially if you get underneath it,
yeah,
then it's going to stick to that leaf rather than roll off.
Right.
There's other ways we can help with that, with like some suffocants and stuff like that.
Yep.
But yeah, very, very much true. And what you're doing right now, you're not foliaring nothing because everything's
okay.
dormant.
Right.
So you're worried about getting that char hit.
Yep.
And the way you're doing that, I know it'll work.
Yep.
Because I've done similar things, not even for remediation, but just to establish areas.
Right.
Char down, chips on top of it, compost extract. What'll happen when you go in there to hydromulch it, half of it'll already have emergent plant on top of it anyway.
Exactly.
It'll be it'll be activating seed banks and harvesting seed that's now coming through the air and catching on that rough surface. One of the things I do different than Dr. Johnson with my bioreactors is I don't cover them.
Yeah.
I cap them at about 4 inches of wood chips.
Yep.
And those wood chips are, I got about 25 yards of wood chips sitting in my field. And I always take the wood chips from the back. So those wood chips are 2-3 years old. And basically it's a form of IMO.
Yep.
That's been sitting there. And when you dig into that, it just reeks of mushrooms.
Right.
So it sits on the top. And then when the thermophilic cycle ends in that compost, which only lasts a few days, that fungi just goes for it and just hammers from the top. It's
absolutely. Yeah. So one of the things that's interesting to point out here is that I've been in conversations with people. We're talking about using compost for bioremediation and so forth. And you literally get people who are like, compost can't do that. And what you get is that commercial bioremediation, okay, in allopathic medicine, we have a joke, we call it one disease, one molecule, right? It's like, oh, you got this disease, we said you have this disease, and therefore we're going to prescribe you this molecule.
Okay.
You take that molecule and it will solve that disease, right? Which, of course, we know how well that works out. Well, in bioremediation, there's kind of a thing that's called one strain, one molecule, right? It's like, or one molecule, one strain, better way to put it. It's like, we go and we test, we realize we have this particular PCB in the soil, right? And so we go and we find, like, some laboratory has done some tests and said that this particular strain of this particular fungi will break down that particular, you know, molecule. Therefore, we're going to go into a lab, we're going to create sterile conditions, we're going to go through and we're going to incubate a huge amount of this one species, one strain of fungi, and then come in and mass apply it. And that'll solve the problem, right? And it's really interesting. It's that mechanistic way of thinking about dealing with nature, because nature never solves a problem like that. The thing is, you just put a vast amount of one strain of fungi out of context down, and a lot of it won't survive. It's just like, what am I doing here? There's too much. What we do with the bioremediation, the way we're talking about, is I call it consortium biology, where we're bringing the whole workforce with all its diversity in, with all its different enzymatic, each different strain and species has its own speciality, knows how to do its own special enzymatic magic and so forth. We put thousands of different strains and species to work on it. The consortium will sort it out and will do a better job than any one. Yeah, exactly. Mechanistic reductionist, right? It's like any one strain could do by itself. So what we're doing with compost is we are working with this diverse thing and we're putting it to work. Same thing happens in your garden. It's like it's the same kind of thing we're working with to get your animals healthy, your plants healthy, but also to bioremediate the toxic mess that was left behind by the gas station down the road when it went away.
You know, and I get the scientific method, and I honestly wish a lot of these studies actually followed it more closely in some ways, because they basically tailor a study to give an outcome because they want the outcome that the person that paid for the study wanted to see. But it also can be overdone. And what I mean by that, I'll be listening to podcasts, especially when they bring scientists on, and especially when they're not field scientists, right? Yeah. They're scientists doing research on biochar, for instance. And I listen to what they say and I go, everything you just said is wrong, even though it's right, because it will never be, you know, we put it in the laboratory and we baked it and under this specific thing. And then we try, like, okay, so just what your example there was of, like, there's this fungus and this fungus will fix this thing.
Yeah.
But what makes that fungus grow?
Right.
What makes that fungus healthy? How many other living things are part of that dynamic ecosystem that fungus is part of? And if we isolate it, that's not how it grows in nature. In nature, right, it grows with its friends. Let's call it that way, right? So if we grow it in a non-sterile environment, if we create it by creating enough diversity that we know it's in there, that it has all of its supporting characters, the supporting cast. You wouldn't go watch a movie with one actor.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if it's Mike Myers and he's playing multiple parts, sure, okay. The 90s was great, right?
Yep.
But, like, you really don't want, like, that's like a plate of salt, right?
Yep.
Salt is a wonderful ingredient, but you don't eat it in a spoon. It goes on other food. And so if you isolate things too much, you lose the interaction. And science has become very myopic, in my opinion, with that, that they can't see the interactions because they're always trying to isolate. And yeah. Some things you should isolate to understand them, but then you mm-hmm. have to reintroduce diversity to see what they're actually going to do. I talked to a very, very gifted man in the world of IMO, and he said, we did one biochar trial, and I wrote it off because it didn't make any difference. Well, this dude's making like the most advanced, you know, IMO concoctions in the world, sprays both fields with them,
yep.
and doesn't notice a difference, and it was a cannabis project. Well, you can only get so much productivity out of that plant. Yep. So, of course, it did good in both places, but you see what I'm saying? Like, there has to be a more holistic look, and yep. what is that field going to do in 5 years is more yep. important to me than what it did in the first year of right. the trial.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I do the professional courses for scientists, engineers, architects, and so forth, the first course we do in that is called the process of regeneration. And it's to get them, like, pull them kicking and screaming out of this mechanistic reductionist paradigm into embracing complexity. I saw somebody mentioned in the chat, complex versus complicated. That's exactly right. It's like what we're dealing with is complexity. And I got to teach them complexity science and to actually embrace the complexity. So the very first session of this course, Process of Regeneration, is exactly this. It is asking this question, why are all these brilliant people creating such a mess? And what I come down to is because what we've done is we've gone into silos. We're thinking in silos. We're trying to solve the problem in silos. And so what I say is we've wound up, because we have all these brilliant people working in silos, with things that are piecewise smart and whole system stupid.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I go back and I follow through why we got into the mechanistic reductionist mindset, when that happened, why we got there, what its impacts were. And then I go through with them and show them rigorously and scientifically why it's impossible to solve the problems we're facing today with that mechanistic reductionist approach alone. And I have to do that to start pulling them out of these siloed disciplines that yeah. they have gotten stuck in.
I can see that. Because they know the one thing they know really well.
Right.
And then when you know one thing really well, and that's your one thing, two things happen. One, you get blind. You get sideblind, like a horse with blinders. Right. But the other thing is you get very defensive.
Yeah.
Like, this is what holds back academia. The professor that wrote the textbook doesn't want to be told that the new research says the textbook is out of date.
Right.
Even if it's only 10% of it needs to be changed, they get very, like, Fifthamish, right? They're going to defend what they have. And right. then they also can't see beyond what they know.
Yep.
So let's do some questions real quick, because I kept you here way longer than I planned on, Alan, and I apologize for that. But
that's okay. These conversations get to going. I think my record so far is there's something out there online with Chris Martinson and I talking for like 3 hours. So
yeah, I get a few Joe Rogan length ones. This one seems like yep. we're headed there. I can't read what his name is. Shouldn't it be non-sustainable to patent genetics because all the new genetic changes that can happen via environmental conditions? I guess he kind of means like, you know, they put out a flu vaccine and it ain't worth a shit because by the yeah. time they put it out, it's already mutated and the vaccine don't work anymore. So, but they do a pretty good job of holding these genetic stacks in stasis by producing new product every year.
Yep. What's interesting is that because of the way we do sequencing and so forth, a lot of times the patents are not on the entire genomic sequence of a thing, but on certain quote-unquote gene sequences.
Correct.
Right? So what they end up doing is they'll find a gene. So, for example, let's go back to glyphosate for a moment. How in the world did we get these genetically modified? Because initially when they came up with the glyphosate, it just killed everything, right?
Yeah.
The idea was you just spray it on there, it kills everything. You wait a while for the glyphosate level to go down to a tolerable level, then you plant. They got all the other competings out of there. But after a while, they found some bacteria that had figured out a way around the glyphosate. So they extracted some genes from the bacteria that allowed the bacteria to get around it, and they said, we're going to just poke this into a soybean plant, right? And they did. And that's how they wound up with genetically modified soybean that can actually withstand glyphosate. Now, the problem is that even today with really advanced genetic technology like CRISPR that lets you go in with a like a scalpel and put genes in exactly where you want them, we still don't understand enough about genetics to do that in a way that is safe.
Okay.
We just don't. We're nowhere near that. And so that's why I'm so opposed to artificially genetically modified plants. Now, here's the interesting thing. When they go looking and saying, oh, you're violating a Monsanto patent, they're looking whether or not that gene sequence is inside of your corn or your soybean or whatever, right? Hey, you're using our gene that we found and patented.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's where that's going. That's how they're able to try to protect their thing. But you're absolutely right. There's this thing in nature called horizontal gene transfer. And it happens most freely among bacteria, where one bacteria figures something out, and then it teaches everybody else how to do it. Next thing you know, all these genes for how to do the thing go everywhere. But we now know that horizontal gene transfer goes between bacteria and plants.
Greg, you let the sheep jump out of the fence, you got to shoot it, because the next thing you know, all the sheep know how to jump out of the fence.
Know how to do it, right? What's interesting, though, is when that happens naturally, nature intelligently inserts the new genetic information into the genome in the way that works. We don't understand how that really works yet. So we are going in and basically being quite arrogant about our knowledge and understanding of genetics. We just don't understand it that well. We just go in and say, yeah, just poke that gene sequence in there. And you're like, well, what does that do? The answer is we don't really know. We're clever enough to be able to do it, but we do not understand its impact. So maybe I hope that answered the question.
I think it does good enough for the time we have left anyway. Hunter says, how many generations to get a plant back to normal from the box store? I start out with don't buy one there.
Exactly my answer. Yeah, start with that. I say is go find the best locally adapted genetics that's still available in your locale. Because almost certainly if you go to the big box store, like most of the plants that you get in seed, well, most of the plants you get, little transplants, come from California greenhouses.
Correct.
Okay. Like I said, I had somebody I worked with that was one of my students that was working in one of those greenhouses for a while. Okay. And seeds that come from a seed store in, say, Oregon down to Florida, genetics are all out of parameter. Find as much as possible, find locally adapted genetics, find local seed banks, go find the old homesteaders that are still growing from seeds they've saved from grandma. You know, that's where you start. And by the way, there's a whole other conversation we have time for on how to do the same thing with perennials and scion wood out of perennial plants. There's a whole conversation of that in rootstock as well. But start with the most locally adapted you can and go forward from there.
And I would say if you just are not in the place to be starting all your own starts yet,
yeah,
then a couple things you can do. One, go on next door and ask if you have local gardeners to start their own seeds.
Right.
And if you tell somebody right now that's not started their seeds for next season yet that you want to buy some plants from them, they will happily make plants for you, right?
Right.
I mean, I would, because it's a couple extra bucks, and you know. And then your second tier of that would be, like, I have a feed store near here named Russell Feeds. This is a very small local chain, and they get their plants from a local greenhouse producer who's probably not doing everything perfectly, but he's not sterile. I know for a fact he's not sterilizing his soil, because I've bought plants, and if you pull a plant out and there's a worm in it in a 4-inch pot, you probably didn't have your soil sterilized, or that worm wouldn't be in there. And it's an extra step that a local producer's probably not going to take. So I would agree with Alan. If you can get seed locally adapted and start yourself, that's the best thing. And then
how
you're
many generations?
You know, look for, because some people just, and I tell people, like, if you can't, starting plants is a skill set.
Yep.
Planting a garden is a skill set. There's only, like, the new people, they only have so many skill sets they can absorb in one season.
Right.
So buying plants from somebody's not bad, but think about your source, I guess.
Yep.
Absolutely. Hey, go ahead.
I was going to say, the question was how many generations? What I would say is this. I'll give you two thoughts. One is I worked with Pat Whitaker towards the end of her program with black Australorps. She took the best black Australorp genetics she could get.
Yeah.
And she worked with them for about 10 years. And her result was like, oh my God. It was like,
really?
So different. It was, that was literally the best chicken genetics I have ever seen anywhere, period. Those birds, I started to, you know, she sent me some eggs. I started to hatch them and so forth. These chicks were showing orientation to aerial predation on day one.
Wow.
These chicks were showing flocking behavior at day two. I mean, and they were brilliant. Like they were the smartest chickens I have ever seen. They were gorgeous. I know, Jack, you saw that picture of that black Australorp cockerel.
Yeah.
It's just gorgeous. That's one of her birds, right?
Okay.
She was able to take in 10 years and go from where the, you know, the black Australorp genetics in the U.S. by and large are pretty mediocre to something truly exceptional in 10 years. Now, on plants, it's really according to how bottlenecked the genetics are.
Yeah.
And how broad of a sample. There's a whole strategy I can show. We don't have time for it here.
Yeah.
On how to do that. But in a couple of years, you can actually recover pretty well. 4 years or so, you can recover a lot of vigor in plants if you do it right.
I mean, one way to look at it is we're trying to be managed wild is the way to look at it, like selectively bred, managed wild. And I used to be into breeding reptiles. And I started working with a very unknown common species in Africa called the house snake.
Yep.
And they're very hard to find cool genetic variances of them in captivity. And I started working with a dude named Donald Sutherland, who would go over to the Highveld in South Africa and actually collect animals out of the wild. And he would send me these little snakes that were wild collected, little snake about this big. And you pull that thing out of the sack it was shipped in. It's been in the mail for 2 days. God knows when it ate last. And that thing would wrap around your finger. And the strength that little animal had compared to a captive bred, you know, boa or something, three times its size, was pound for pound. You felt like when you're a kid and you put the rubber band on your finger and it turned purple, like that.
Yep.
And they're not aggressive. They're pretty docile little critters. They might bite. They don't hurt. But they were just doing it because that's what they did. That's their natural instinct, is to grab onto something so they don't fall. And the first time I pulled one out of that, I was like, oh, my God, this is different. And that's what we're really talking about, is trying to move back to the wild trait, but what we want from a domestic species that we've managed its evolution, right? It's managed wild evolution, if that's a term, maybe we just made it. Hey, Alabama wants to know if you have a book. I don't think you do.
Well, I have a couple books on completely different subjects, but coming out here pretty soon, just to answer this, three things I'm working on right now. Now that I've transitioned into doing regenerative design like as a full-time thing. There's three things. One is we'll have the biocompatible design standards draft out here pretty soon. That's pretty technical. I won't get into that. That's a set of technical standards that several big technical groups want on how to create the technologies that won't be destructive. So it's the whole systems standard. The second is another geeky book and a bunch of people want. Here you go for a title, Jack. The Dynamics of Regenerative and Sustainable Holons.
Wow, you're going to be a thousandaire.
Well, the reason for this is because if you notice that all of the definitions of regenerative and sustainable are absolutely crap.
Garbage, yeah.
And so what happened was a bunch of these big technical groups were like, we don't have any actionable definition of what sustainable actually means. They're putting all these billions of dollars into it.
They don't even know what it is.
They don't even know what it is, right? And so they brought me in and I started to say, here's what sustainable and regenerative really means. Here's technically rigorous definitions. They're like, oh my God, you got to put that into a book so we can cite it and reference it. We can reference it in our standards and everything. So that's that book. The third one is actually more interesting for this audience if they're more serious designers. And that one's, we're going to be finishing up next year. It's called Observation for Design.
Okay.
And this one comes with this. I've taught so many really bright people how to do design. And what I've noticed is that I've got people with all like advanced degrees and everything. You take them out on the landscape and their observation skills are zero.
None.
They can't see a bloody thing.
Yeah.
We're going out and I'm saying, looking at things and we're trying to like, you know, their ecological literacy is zero. Their ability to like just see what's in front of their eyes is zero. This is a semester-long course where you are reading a little bit of stuff that I give you, and then you are journaling and mapping and drawing to develop the skills of being able to actually see the whole system dynamics going on in front of you.
Yeah.
So this is something we're going to be doing with our high-level students, because we've noticed that we've run this with people as a prototype before. When we bring them into a design course, it's the difference is night and day. All of a sudden they come in and they're able to, like, if we get people who haven't had this course, they tend to stay in the room and heads down a piece of paper in abstract thought, trying to design on the land. And I'm constantly trying to get them, get out, go out, look at the land you're trying to design. You can't design the land from in here, right? But the people who've done the observation for design, they're out there on the land. They're walking around, they're looking, and they're interacting.
You have to, because I know you've had to have had this experience. You're designing something, let's say a food forest, and it's a relatively small piece, like an acre and a half.
Yeah.
You go look at the land. You make a plot. You start designing it on paper. And when you go back and look at it as you're working on the design, the whole thing seems smaller than it did in your head, because when it was on paper, it was huge.
Yeah.
And now then you see it, even though you saw it already. You've got to spend time in the field. The sustainable regenerative thing, I think, is really important. I love Paul Wheaton. I know you've worked with him too, but the way he defines sustainable, I think, is missing the boat, because he calls it barely hanging on.
Yeah.
And I know where he's coming from, but something can be sustainable and regenerative. Sustainable just means it can keep going either indefinitely or at least for a very long time. And the way I try to explain that is, you know what's sustainable? 100% sustainable for the purpose of a human life, infinitely sustainable. The environment on Mars,
mm-hmm,
is infinitely sustainable. It will look, if we don't touch it, it will look exactly like it does right now, 10,000 years from now. It's
exactly
infinitely
right.
Sustainable. It's not useful.
Right. So, Here's what I do. Regenerative and degenerative is one thing. Sustainable and unsustainable is a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Regenerative versus degenerative is a system dynamic. Right?
Yeah.
So what you're talking about is that currently the atmosphere on Mars is a degenerative system dynamic.
Correct.
The system on Earth, the biosphere, is a regenerative system. Now, sustainable versus unsustainable has to do with whether we can maintain that system state over time.
Correct.
So what I do in order to define sustainable technically rigorously is I start by defining regenerative rigorously, starting with thermodynamics, right? And I give an engineering definition of regenerative. And then I say, all right, now we're going to define sustainable, because you could actually be regenerative and unsustainable.
Yeah.
You could create a system which is currently in a regenerative state, but you can't hold it there and it's going to collapse and burn pretty soon.
Yeah.
So that's regenerative and unsustainable. And when I say that for the first time, people are like, oh my God, because it's like a complete reframe for them.
Yeah.
Right. So I say what we're trying to be is, that's why I said the title is the dynamics of regenerative and sustainable holons.
Yeah.
Okay. Sustainable means in the way we're going towards is it's a regenerative system state that we can hold it there through a number of adaptive cycles and in the face of certain levels of disturbance. That's what sustainable means, because it's like complex systems adapt and evolve, and if it falls apart the first time it has to adapt and evolve, it's not sustainable. It's got to be able to adapt and evolve through multiple iterations of adaptation, right? Otherwise, it's not sustainable.
Correct.
Number two, it has to be resilient, because if the first breeze that comes along knocks everything down, that's not sustainable either. So the technical definition I'm going for on sustainable is regenerative system dynamic that can be maintained over multiple adaptive cycles and in the face of, multiple sigma disruptive events. That is where I'm going with that definition. That's an actionable engineering definition, right?
And we have to engineer. We have to engineer for the type of thing we're talking about, humans into it, because an example would be like one of Jeff Lawton's videos. It's like a 300-year-old food forest in Vietnam.
Yep.
And they know it's 300 years because that's how long it's been in the family. Well,
right.
The family's maintained it for 300 years.
Yeah.
Is that sustainable and regenerative? Yes, but if that family moves off of there,
right,
it's going to success into some. It might hold on for a while, but eventually it's not going to be what it is anymore. It might be even good what it becomes if nobody messes it up.
Right.
But there's a 1,000-year-old one in Morocco or something like that, all these date palms and stuff, but it's been managed for 1,000 years. So right. If you had a property like mine, and I'm the only one that does anything here, if I don't design it right, as soon as I die, it's gone.
Right. Exactly. And I include that in my definition because what we talk about, like, what would it mean to build a sustainable building, right? And it's like the building itself is a degenerative asset. It's like it's going to fall apart.
Yes.
And so, I mean, this will go way off on a deep end. I don't want to go too far down this path. But what I point out is that the termite mounds in Africa, right, the termite mound itself is an integral part of the superorganism of the termite colony.
Okay.
The termite mound itself starts to fall apart as soon as the termites go away.
Yes.
But while the termites are there, that whole system is, you know, sustainable and regenerative. Because what's happening is a byproduct of the termiting is to maintain this whole thing, right? And that is they have decided that instead of each individual termite having a thermoregulatory system, that the whole colony will manage this nest, and the termite mound will be the thermoregulatory organ for all of the termites. Therefore, it's what one physiologist calls an external physiological organ.
Yeah.
Right? Now, buildings are an external physiological organ for us to keep us warm in the wintertime and so on and so forth. And therefore, the only way to look at a building as being sustainable is to define the building as a process that includes the humans. That's the only way to define a building in such a way that the building can be sustainable.
You made me think of my old freshwater biology teacher when I learned about pond secession.
Yep.
And eventually it becomes a marsh and it's gone. And I said, well, what if I don't want it to? And he said, well, if you build it right, you won't have to worry about it, but your kids will have to dredge it. Like there's some point you have to do something to keep it. You're managing something. You're stacking in time and space, but then at some point you're wanting to slow it down, pause it, and keep it from going to the next level. Let's move on because I said I had you a long time here. Chef Ken, Drink, Eat, Learn says, for me, the support accumulates in the kitchen. How can more chefs, brewers, distillers contribute to like heritage grain to glass or to plate? I think this is incredibly important. And because if you want to incentivize farmers, I'm sure you've heard this term, a farmer saying, I don't get paid anything for flavor. But what if people respond to incentives, right? I had a chef that was buying duck eggs for me, and I had this one Fuyu persimmon here, and I handed him that, and he ate it, and he about came out of his skin excited. And I'm like, don't get too excited. I can't run a persimmon orchard where I am.
Right.
But if somebody could produce that, that dude would have bought all he could have got.
Right.
I can't think of the guy's name. I know he's associated with Gabe Brown and Ray Occhioletta's group, but he's not one of them. He's somewhere in the Midwest, and he has all these kids now that their dads and stuff had given them like an acre of the farm because the farm won't support another person on payroll. So they send the kids off to college. They give them an acre, and they do their I can't think what it's called now, like FFA and stuff like that, and they're doing mixed vegetables. And he's loading up a truck with a trailer once a week and taking it to Chicago. And these kids are making more on an acre or two than their parents are making on 1,000.
Yep.
In actual profit that they get to keep.
Right.
Because there's a demand. So I think that turning on chefs, because you could turn on homeowners and they'll buy a little bit. But when one restaurant, the amount you sell to one restaurant, I've done duck eggs. They're buying 80 dozen eggs a month from us when we were running as a commercial operation off 3 acres.
Yep.
And if we could have made another 20, they would have bought them.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. I think one of the things that's interesting now is that the paradigm whereby you can't get paid for flavor is changing, and it's changing on two fronts. One of them is that there is a increasing understanding that flavor is has some equivalency to nutrient density. And there's a lot of reasons to understand that. Like, remember what I said, like low Brix plants have watery sap. They also have a tendency to have no flavor. So people are starting to realize that nutrient dense real food also is flavorful food, because a lot of those real amazing flavor compounds are plant secondary metabolites. you have to have a very healthy plant to get that. I mean, when we get to a tomato that has leaf bricks, not the bricks in the tomato, but leaf bricks of like 12, and you eat that tomato, it's like all of a sudden that tomato has floral notes and all these complex flavors, and it's got like this really amazing, like bitter note that's really subtle, but kind of adds, you know, pungency to the whole thing. And it's like, oh my God, right? That is just like, no hydroponic tomato can even begin to compete with that in terms of flavor. But also, not only is it so much better to eat in terms of taste, but then your body feels the fact that you just got all these nutrients that you were missing from the hydroponic tomato. The second way that you can actually get paid for flavor is that higher Brix produce has a tendency to last on the shelf longer. It will spoil more slowly. And so we're actually seeing in some countries like Australia and New Zealand, grocers are starting to actually pay farmers more for high Brix produce, not because it's more flavorful, not because it's more healthy, but because their losses to spoilage are lower.
Yep. Absolutely. So,
come back to the question here. I think that the kitchen, chefs and in the kitchen they're in such an amazing place to help people understand how to connect back to the local food shed. You know, they can basically promote an understanding of why the food that they are serving is nutrient dense and flavorful and came from a local farm and what all that means. And, you know, the fact that you, as one person put it, you can either pay the farmer or you can pay the doctor. You know, it's kind of like, and the quality of life of paying the farmer is a lot higher. So I think we'll pay the farmer, right? And so I think there's a huge amount of this for having people come in and do special events where people come in and there's a whole bunch of that. I do workshops, and when I do the workshop, you know, I've had a friend of mine who's come in and run the kitchen for me every time, and we make the kitchen an integral part of the workshop. They'll come out and explain exactly where the food came from, why we're preparing it the way we did, what the nutrient density of the food is, why we avoided certain things, and so forth. And what has ended up happening from that is over and over again, we had to start actually putting together, every time we did a workshop, I would have to do a custom little booklet of all the recipes that we served, because what would happen is people would go home and start making those recipes at home.
And they didn't.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it was like, next thing you know, I got people calling me going, you have more recipes? What are we doing? And like, so what we realized was when we serve this food to people, I have people show up at workshops, 4-day workshop, day 3, come to me and say, my digestive system is actually functioning properly for the first time in 7 years. And I know it's the food.
Yeah.
You have to explain to me why this is happening, right?
Yeah.
And so like that. And of course, these people being fed food like that for a few days, feeling the effects of
they
just
3 or 4 days,
they're like, how do I do this? And so I think that's the answer.
Food is medicine, right? It's the right food, right? Yeah. It's also poison if it's the wrong food. Like what you're talking about there made me think of when we were doing commercial operation and we just got out of that. We have other things to be doing. And we had the one restaurant we were selling to that did our duck egg on top of this sweet potato duck confit thing. That was their big seller. And they had us come in and they were farm to table. And we had all these local producers with a table. And then all of their customers were coming around and meeting us and hearing how we grew the food that the restaurant prepared.
Right.
I think we need, not only do we need more of that, I think there's room for chefs who don't really want to work in the kitchen anymore to coordinate that, because like one of my best friends, a dude named John up in New Hampshire, he does microgreens. And the reason he like owns New Hampshire for the microgreen market, like owns, because he worked in restaurants. So he can go talk to chefs. He can walk in their kitchen and he knows things like behind you because it's a cramped environment. He knows their language, their lingo. He knows what day. He knows like Tuesday and Thursday is the day you go talk to the chef. You don't go talk to the chef on fucking Friday. Like you don't do that because that's the busiest day of the week. He knows the day. Like, so those guys know how to talk the language, the lingo, the timing, everything. And we need to coordinate more of that. And then the taste, here's an example of this. A friend of mine named Neil Franklin, who I used to be a business partner with, came and visited me at our place we had in Arkansas. And I went out in the garden, pulled some carrots out of the bed, and just did butter, sage, salt, wrapped in foil, threw it on the grill with some steaks I was making.
Yep.
He eats these carrots. He goes, "You have to tell me how to do this." I'm like, "You saw me do it. Take the carrots, clean them, put them on the foil, real butter, real sage, salt. That's it." So about 3 months later, I get a phone call. And I haven't thought about this since then. And you know how the British are. They can say very harsh things, but it sounds elegant. Like, "You drafted. You lied to me." That's the first. Yep. No, hello, no, nothing. I'm like, "What the hell are you talking about?" Right? He goes, "That didn't work." I'm like, "What didn't work?" He goes, the carrots. And finally I figured this out. I go, "What, the carrots I made you?" He goes, "Yeah, you left out something. There's an ingredient you left out. You bastard, you know?" And I'm like, yes. "Neil, where'd you get your carrots?"
Right.
He's like, "Whole Foods, they're good carrots." I'm sure they're good, but the carrots you ate at my place were not just grown in a great environment. They were pulled out of the ground and cooked within 5 minutes.
Right.
You will never make them like that.
Yes.
And if chefs experience that, there is no going back for them after that.
Absolutely.
So they want to quest for it the way a drug addict goes for, like, you know, chasing the angel type thing.
Yep. So I want to say to, the last question, it's like, I worked with the group. It never quite worked. We almost got to it, and they didn't do it at the very end. They were talking about doing a community garden, but doing it right. And so we were going to do compost, aerated compost tea. We were going to produce all of it. And then I had done a design for the garden to be this educational space, but it had an outdoor-indoor kitchen convertible and a dining space. And so we were in an herbal medicine garden and a bunch of other stuff in it. And what we were looking at was growing this nutrient-dense real food, bringing people in, including children, to learn how to do it, and then bringing in high-end chefs. And the way I set the whole thing up, it was like indoor-outdoor kitchen so that the cooking could be almost like cooking theater, right? Cooking over fire, cooking with fire, all this sort of stuff. And then this beautiful indoor-outdoor dining space so you could dine in the garden.
Yeah.
Right. And so you bring people in, you bring in high-end chefs who take the food right out of the, like you said, right out of the ground, right into this beautiful kitchen. I put the design had a big cob oven right in the center of it to do that, but it also had a rocket oven and some other things like that in it. You have them cook this food, bring it right out and present it on the table. This becomes an convertible educational space, dining space. You can teach people how to cook nutrient-dense real food. You can teach people how to compost, all in a space that was like an acre.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And it would have been like a destination space for the entire community. Anybody can get a group that wants to do that, I'll jump in and help design it. It's like, because we need examples of that in order to get this exact thing going. People need to be able to come, taste it, experience it, then they get it. It's like they have to have that, because reading about it in the book is not the same as having like your British friend experiencing it, right? It's like, and being able to see the garden and the kitchen and the whole thing and have somebody explain it to them. Yes, this is how we produce the magic. This is how, and not only is it fantastic, but it also is the thing that'll keep you from getting sick.
I'll put it this way. Like, I can make really great ceviche with fish that I buy at a fish market. It will never taste like it does when I pull one out of the water and the gills are literally still going while the lime juice is being mixed. It will never be the same. There's something about that. And that's how we ate as humans, right? Like, the thing we didn't eat today that we put aside, the ant and the grasshopper, ants, that's a survival ration.
Right.
Right. That's not a thriving ration. That's
right.
We know at some point there will be no food we can get right now. So we need to put something aside. But day to day, we ate what we could pick up and stick in our beaks. Right. That's it.
Yeah.
Real quick on these last two and I'll let you go. Annie says, is the vaginal birth issue the same around the world? I would imagine it's the same around the world where we practice Western medicine.
Yeah. No, I mean, the what I said about vaginal birth is true for pretty much all mammals, as far as I know, and of course for all humans. So
I think they mean the problem side, Alan.
Yeah.
Problem side.
So what I mean by that is that if you have nutrient deficiency,
okay,
then the secondary sexual characteristics of all mammals seem to be somewhat reduced. And so what you'll find is as far as I've been able to tell, anywhere you go in the world in which they have switched to a westernized diet from their indigenous diet, and Weston A. Price documented this in the early 20th century. Every time he went and found, he found a lot of groups where there were indigenous people, so they're all the same genetic stock, right? And when he was traveling around, it was in a moment when the Western diet was being widely adopted. And what he was able to find were people who were indigenous to place, who had been there for many generations, and there was part of the population that was still eating their indigenous diet, and there was a part of the population that had just switched over to a westernized diet. Okay? So you had the control group, and you had the experimental group. The control group was all the people who were still eating their traditional diet after thousands of years. They were all healthy. They could all vaginally deliver. They all had wide dental palates with the teeth coming in straight, almost no cavities. That was almost so on and so forth. The people that were over on the Western diet, these were their brothers, their children, same genetic stock. All of these issues emerged in the first generation that went to this diet. Okay, you started to see them growing up with the teeth all cattywampus, with, you know, secondary sexual characteristics diminished, with all kinds of other problems. So what I would say is anywhere in the world we have looked, when people have gone off of healthy, nutrient-dense, indigenous diets and moved over to a westernized diet, these issues of chronic degenerative disease and all these other issues emerge almost immediately.
Awesome. Awesome. Last one. What are the germination conditions for bindweed? How do you discourage it from growing?
Honestly, I have never rolled across bindweed at scale.
Okay.
I haven't either. So I haven't had to play with it. My question would be, so here's my mindset. So I have to go and research this, but here's my question. My first question is, where in ecological succession does bindweed fall? Is it a weedy pioneer species, or is it a later succession species? Right? That's my very first question. I don't happen to know off the top of my head. But here's the thing. Any weedy species, it's a pioneer species, it is basically going to germinate in a disrupted, disturbed soil that is bacterially dominant. That is its germination condition. So anything that you're trying to not have grow, you are going to try to get mid-succession conditions. This means that you got fungi and bacteria in biological balance. Their biomass is about the same. We're not disturbing the soil. We have soil organic matter beginning to be created. We have several, like, you know, over 3% soil organic matter that's in the soil, so on and so forth. When we do that, what we start seeing is that the early succession species tend to not germinate. That's what you're able to do. You can use a aerated compost tea compost that's more fungally dominated to move you towards later succession ecology in your soil. So, you know,
this is my only experience with it. When I moved into this property, we have an Arrowesus varduck house. It's a 10 by 12 tough shed, and it's got two fenced areas. And the back larger fenced area was probably a quarter acre, and it looked like a bindweed garden.
Yep.
And these people had like two goats, and apparently they put the goats out there all the time. The goats ate everything but the bindweed because they didn't like it.
Yep.
And they were feeding the goats pellets and hay. Right. So the goats had no real incentive to browse beyond what they liked.
Right.
It was just a place for them to exercise.
Yep.
First thing I did was tear the fence down and open it up to the full acre on that side. They had a 3-acre property, 1 acre out there, and then 2 acres on this side.
Right.
I opened it up and I kept the other area contained because I had so many ducks, they couldn't all stay in the house at night. So I electro fenced it. And I, because you got that many birds,
Yep.
When they come home at night, they shit everywhere. So yep. We capped it in about 4 inches deep of wood chips. The larger area is downhill from there, so you had a nutrient cycle start going down the hill.
Downhill. Yep.
I did nothing to that area other than let the ducks run through it on a rotation, the ducks and geese and chickens. I still have bindweed along the fence. The rest of it is gone. I did nothing but increase the biological activity. The other thing, and people that have been here, another pest problem in the South is sandburrs.
Yep.
There were people 3 or 4 years after they'd been to a workshop here posting pictures in our group saying, is anybody still finding these? Because they had sandburrs in their clothes and stuff. You can't find one now.
Right.
I didn't do anything specific to get rid of sandburrs. I just increased the fertility of the land. And this is a hard piece of land. Do not think this is a Garden of Eden or anything here. This is, I've got 4 inches of dirt and limestone underneath it. Like, I do not have a battery for moisture. This is hard conditions. And those two, which are considered like the worst, most invasive problems, simply by running animals on them and increasing biology, one completely disintegrated and went away. And the other one is it's pretty wild morning glories on the fence. That's all it is now. And I've never cut one. I've never chopped one. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that plant is it produces from rhizome and seed. And it makes a lot of seed if you let it go all the way through. So if you're really fighting it, you might want to just cut it off before it goes to seed. That'll at least help. And
it'll help. I think the thing to realize.
See this picture right here? Yep. For those that are not, it's you got to find it. You got to come here and see the video if you're on the audio only. Do not till bindweed. You just multiplied it. You know?
Exactly right. And you've created, every time you till, you just create these conditions for germinations of a lot of stuff. It's like anytime you see any animal or plant going and becoming prolific and becoming invasive, look at it and say, this is an ecological imbalance of some sort. And so what you're basically, instead of going to war with the thing, oftentimes what you realize is that thing is being successful because it is working with an unbalanced ecological niche. Something in the ecology is unbalanced. It's created a set of conditions in which this particular species can become hyper successful, right? When you start to restore ecological balance, then typically in the vast majority of cases, that invasive species or proliferation of a species starts to come back into ecological balance and you can begin to work with it. And so if it is a pioneer species, oftentimes the pioneer species specializes in some working with some in a particularly disrupted environment. And so you can say, hey, great, it's here to help repair this particular, you know, disrupted environment. How do I help it finish, you know, fixing the disruption faster so that its proliferation and so forth can come back down into ecological balance? That's usually how I try to go after it.
Yeah. Okay. I think that works. Alan, you want to tell people how they can find out more about you and your work, and then we'll wrap up here.
Sure. I mean, what I've been doing mostly on the teaching side has been with what we call the Institute of Integrated Regenerative Design. Bit of a mouthful, but the Integrated Regenerative Design Framework is the framework I created to teach all of these scientists, engineers, architects, urban planners how to do large-scale regenerative design, right? And so we are now turning that in and scaling that up and beginning to teach classes at a larger scale there. And we're going to be putting out a whole new curriculum starting out in January. And so you can go to i2rd.co, and that is where we are currently in the process of redoing that whole website to put all the new classes on there. But all of our classes will be on that site, and that is for the professional side. Jack, I think we're going to come back and talk about something we're doing on the faith-based side a little later.
Okay.
And that we're going to be rolling out next year, and that's going to have a lot more training where we partner with, like Jack, what you're doing with your training and so forth, to help people. We're going to help people with the big picture of how to do this as a community. And then there's a lot of really great resources for like, okay, well, we need to do biochar. Well, go look at Jack's class because, you know, he's got that nailed down. So what we're looking at doing is helping to have people understand how to attack this at the systems level and create faith-based organizations that allow for communities to do things like tend their own genetics and, you know, grow their own nutrient-dense food and repair their own landscapes and hydrology and so forth. So that will be coming next year. We're going to really announce that big.
Awesome, man. Well, hey, as you develop things, you've got information, you need any support getting out the word on things, you got a course coming up, let me know. Even if you're not on the air, it doesn't matter. I'll put it out for you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you, Alan. Thank you for being with us today and giving us almost 3 hours of your time, man.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jack.
Bye now. All right, guys, real quick. We went long, so I'm just going to go really fast with my wrap up today. I just want to let you know I do have a new item of the day for you. It's from Vivor. It's this badass stainless steel table. I've got a video review of it as well. It's on wheels. It's about 3 foot by 2 foot on the surface. It's a really great tool. It's on sale for like $87. And I don't think you could buy the stainless steel and the casters that come with it for the price of the table. It's just a really great deal. It'd be a nice, like a mobile island in your kitchen, or something like that. So check it out. And again, you can always find everything I recommend at tspaz.com. I had some other stuff, but I'm going to leave it at that today. I appreciate all of you. We talked about a lot of things today, like biochar and stuff like that. Check out Home Food Systems if you haven't yet. We have some really great courses there. The biochar course is being made right now. It's going to probably be February before it's done. It's becoming really involved. But the other two, there's three other courses there. One of them's free, homefoodsystems.com. And consider joining the MSB. That's how you can support us and make sure that we're always here. With that, I'll catch you tomorrow with an expert counsel show. Friday flashbacks. We'll do it all again next week.
Run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.